But if it's more powerful, will our existing guns be up to firing it?
That's an excellent question, and I don't have a good answer, Merlin admitted. From what I've seen of your artillery, it's well made, but it was all designed for meal powder, not corned powder. I think you're going to have to experiment to find out.
I can see that, Seamount nodded. We've always proofed our guns by firing them with double or triple charges and loads of shot. I suppose we should start by firing some of them with standard charges, by weight, of corned powder, then increase the loading until they fail.
That sounds reasonable to me, Merlin agreed. One thing, though, you may have to thicken the walls of the gun tubes to stand up to the power of the new powder, but you can probably reduce the barrel length. Seamount raised an eyebrow, and Merlin chuckled. The main reason you've needed as much length as you've got now is to give the powder time to burn before the ball leaves the bore, he pointed out. Since corned powder burns more quickly, you won't need the same barrel length to get the same effect.
You're right.
Seamount's eyes gleamed as he considered the implications.
So we could reinforce the thickness and might still end up saving weight overall, and...
His eyes glowed even more brightly as his agile mind raced onward.
A shorter gun can be reloaded more quickly, can't it?
Yes, it can. Merlin nodded, then stroked his mustachios again. In fact, I just had another thought, one that would probably increase your rate of fire even more.
What sort of thought?
Seamount's eyes narrowed into hawk-like intensity. Well, Merlin said slowly, frowning as he obviously worked through the implications himself, you've always loaded each round using ladles of loose powder, haven't you? Seamount nodded quickly with an "of course we have" sort of expression, and Merlin shrugged. Well, he said again, suppose you were to pre-measure the charge for each shot. You could sew each charge into a cloth bag. Then you could just ram the bag home each time you load. And if the bag's weave was loose enough, the primer would burn a hole through the cloth and ignite the main charge.
Langhorne, Seamount muttered.
He closed his eyes for a moment, thinking hard, then began to nod. Slowly at first, then faster and harder.
You're absolutely right,
he said, reopening his eyes, still nodding.
I'll bet we could at least double, probably triple, our rate of fire if we did that, and...
His nodding stopped abruptly.
I don't see any reason we couldn't do the same thing for our field artillery, or even Langhorne. We could come up with a way for musketeers with this new flintlock of yours to do the same kind of thing instead of using powder horns.
Merlin blinked in apparent astonishment, and, truth be told, he was just a little astonished. He'd known Baron Seamount had a first-class brain, but he was delighted by how quickly the naval officer was grappling with the new possibilities. The Seijin had hoped introducing the basic concepts would produce this sort of synergy, but he hadn't expected even Seamount to grab them and run this quickly. On the other hand, he reminded himself, one reason the Carissians are so tough at sea is that they've invented the concept of a professional navy. Everybody else still insists on sticking army officers, preferably nobly born ones, whether they have any brains or not, aboard a ship to command it in battle. The professional sailors are only along to steer the thing where their landlubber commanders tell them to go. Aside from that, they're supposed to keep their big mouths shut. But not in Karis. I wonder if Seamount really realizes just how big an advantage that gives his people. The professional naval officer in question turned to look at the diagrams chalked on one wall of his office. That entire wall was paneled in slabs of slate, turning it into one huge blackboard. And when they'd first entered the office, it had been covered by half a dozen sketches and jotted reminders to himself. But Seamount had swept them impatiently away and begun creating new ones with sharp, crisp strokes of his chalk as they spoke. Now he considered those newly created sketches and notes and shook his head slowly.
"Some of our officers are going to resist all this, you know, Sejin," he said.
"Why do you say that?"
"Sejin Merlin,"
Seamount replied with something trapped halfway between a snort and a chuckle.
"You've been very tactful this afternoon. I'm fairly confident, though, that most of my own brilliant notions had already occurred to you before we began."
Merlin felt his face smooth into momentary betraying non-expression, and the Carisian laughed.
"That wasn't a complaint," he said. "And while I have my own suspicions about just why you might prefer for us to figure it all out for ourselves, I'm not going to worry about confirming them either. But when you take all of this together, the new powder, these trunnions of yours, the new gun carriages, this idea of pre-measured charges, the shorter barrel length, it's going to stand every established notion of how naval battles are fought on its head. I haven't had time to consider all of it yet, of course, but one thing is obvious. Every war galley in the Navy just became useless."
"I don't know if I'd go quite that far," Merlin said cautiously, but Seamount shook his head again, this time crisply, decisively.
"It won't work with galleys,"
he said, and his chalk rapped on slate with tack-hammer sharpness as he tapped the rough schematic of the new-style gun carriage with it.
"We're going to have to come up with something else, a whole new set of tactics and tactical formation. At the moment, the only real possibility I see is some development of the galleon, even though Langhorne knows we don't have many of them to play with. I suspect,"
he gave Merlin another sharp-eyed glance,
"that you and Sir Dustin are going to be discussing that shortly. But it's obvious a galley simply doesn't have any place to put enough guns, not if we can design and mount cannon that fire as quickly as I think we'll be able to fire now. They'll have to be mounted along the broadside of the ship, not just in the bow castle and stern castle, and you can't do that in a galley. The rowers would be in the way, and they don't have the load-bearing capability for that much weight of metal."
"But unless there's a fairly strong wind, a galley is faster than a sailing ship, and galleys are almost always more maneuverable," Merlin pointed out. "And all of those rowers are more marines when it comes to the boarding melee."
"Doesn't matter,"
Seamount said almost brusquely.
"As long as the sailing ship has enough way on her to keep her broadside pointed at the galley, no galley will survive to board her. Not with a dozen or so heavy cannon firing round shot straight into the galley's teeth, anyway. And battles between cannon-armed ships won't be settled by boarding most of the time, either."
"Oh," he waved his maimed hand,
"it'll probably happen from time to time, anyway, but usually—"
He shook his head again, sharply.
"Usually the business will be settled one way or another before anyone gets close enough to board."
Merlin looked at him for a moment, then tossed his head in a gesture of agreement. Although, he thought, Seamount may just be getting a bit ahead of himself. There were plenty of boarding actions during the canvas and cannon era on old Earth. Still, he's headed in the right direction. And he's right that the old-fashioned land battle at sea is about to become a thing of the past. "I see what you mean," he said aloud. "And you're right. I had realized we'd need to come up with a new design for warships with the new guns even before you and I started talking. That's one reason I was going to suggest you sit in with Sir Dustin and me when we begin talking. You've undoubtedly got a better appreciation of how things are going to have to change than I do, and we might as well get it right from the beginning."
"I certainly agree with that,"
Seamount nodded emphatically.
"And I imagine Sir Dustin is going to explain to me why I can't build the ship I'd really like to. Just putting this much weight onto its decks is bound to create all sorts of problems. And even after he and I, and you, of course, Sejin, come to some sort of compromise agreement on that, we're going to have to figure out how to sell it to the rest of His Majesty's officers as well."
"And just to make your life even a little bit more complicated," Merlin said with a grin, You're going to have to figure out how to convince them without letting Narmin and Hector realize what's coming.
Oh, thank you, Sajin Merlin.
Don't mention it. But now I believe it's time for my first conversation with Master Hausman and Master Mikhail. We've got quite a few things to discuss, including the best way to make your new canon. After that, I'm supposed to meet with Sir Dustin for the first time about 3 hours from now, and we'll have several other things to discuss, in addition to your new warship design. So, if I might suggest, perhaps I should leave you to consider exactly what ingredients you want incorporated into it while I go and discuss those other things with Master Hausman, Master Mikhail, and him. Could you join us in the Citadel in perhaps 4 hours or so?
I'll be there,
Seamount promised, and turned his rapt attention back to the chalk diagrams as Merlin quietly left the office.
I can see what you've got in mind, Sajin Merlin,
Edward Hausman said, sitting back from the conference table and gazing at the side-by-side pencil sketches.
And I imagine Sir Alfred was drooling by the time you showed him these trunnions of yours.
He reached out and tapped the closer of the two drawings with an index finger. It showed one of the new, modified artillery pieces Merlin was proposing. There were several differences between it and the standard type currently carried aboard the Royal Carisian Navy's galleys, but the most significant one was the way the gun itself was mounted. Current cannon were basically simply huge muskets, a hollow tube of metal tightly affixed to a long, straight, heavy wooden timber by metal bands. When the gun was fired, the timber recoiled across the deck until the combination of friction and the heavy tackle anchoring the gun to the gunport through which it fired brought it to a halt. The crew then reloaded and dragged the massive timber back into position by sheer brute strength. There was no way to elevate or depress the gun's point of aim. Dragging the ponderous timber across the deck required a lot of muscle power, at least if the gun was heavy enough to actually damage another ship's hull, and even a well-trained gun crew did well to get off a single shot every 5 minutes or so. But the new piece Merlin had sketched had something called trunnions, which were no more than cylindrical protrusions cast into the barrel and set at right angles to the gun's bore. They were long enough and thick enough to support the gun's weight, and they fitted into cutouts in the gun carriage, the wheeled gun carriage, which went under the piece. It was a ridiculously simple concept, Hausman reflected, but the implications were huge. The gun pivoted up and down on the trunnions, which meant it could be elevated or depressed with ludicrous ease. The carriage's wheels, or trucks, as Merlin insisted upon calling them for some reason, meant it could be brought back to battery far more quickly and with a smaller gun crew for a given weight of weapon. And because of all that, and the fact that the pieces were so much shorter and handier, the rate of fire had to go up hugely.
The problem, as I see it, the foundry owner continued, is twofold. First, we're going to need a lot of these guns of yours. It won't do us much good to have two or three ships armed with them if the rest of the fleet isn't, and the whole point is to put enough of them aboard each ship to make that ship's weight of fire decisive. That means we're going to need more bronze than anyone's ever needed before, and someone's going to have to mine and smelt the stuff. Either that, or we're going to have to figure out how to make them out of iron, and that's a much riskier proposition. But, second, even if we get our hands on the metal, just casting and boring the guns is going to take time, lots of time, and be sort of hard to conceal from someone like Hector's eyes.
I agree those are going to be problems, Edward, Mikhail said, leaning back in his own chair and tapping his front teeth with the knuckle of his right index finger. I don't think they're insurmountable ones, though. Not if His Majesty is prepared to invest enough gold in the project, at any rate.
Doing it in secret? Hausman shook his head. We don't have enough capacity here at Helen for half the guns Sir Alfred's going to want, Rayan. I know we could increase it, but we're going to need hundreds of workers to produce as many new guns as we're going to require, And even if we had those, I don't even know if there's enough space here at King's Harbour for the facilities we'll need in the long term.
Agreed, Mikhail nodded.
On the other hand, what about Delphac?
Hausman started to shake his head, then paused with an arrested expression.
There's nothing there yet, he said after a moment,
and Mikhail shrugged.
And your point is?
The older man stopped tapping his teeth and jabbed his index finger at Merlin's sketches.
You just said we might need to consider iron guns, and that we'd have to expand the capacity here at Helen, assuming there were enough space for it, which there isn't. How much harder would it be to build the capacity from scratch somewhere else? And you certainly planned to do exactly that when you bought the land up there in the first place, didn't you?
Well, yes,
Hausman said slowly, then glanced at Merlin.
Just how freely does His Majesty intend to spend in this effort, Sajin Merlin?
He hasn't told me that, Merlin replied. I don't know if he's discussed it with Prince Caleb yet either, but he may well have. My impression is that he regards all of these projects as critical, but the treasury isn't exactly bottomless.
May I ask why?
Ryan has just reminded me about an investment of mine over near Big Tirion. I picked up quite a bit of land from Earl Highrock a few years ago. It's near Delphac, right on the river, and Highrock's been trying to get someone to develop the iron deposits on the other side of the river.
The foundry owner shrugged.
It's an excellent location in a lot of ways, but there aren't many people in the area, no labor force to recruit from. And Delphac's a tiny little village, not much more than a wide, muddy spot in a road. I've got a smallish operation in place there, but it's not much yet. I've had to import my entire workforce, and we'd have to start essentially from scratch to develop it further.
But the very fact that there aren't many people there already might work for us from the secrecy aspect, Merlin said thoughtfully.
That's what Ryan had in mind, Hausman agreed. But at this particular moment, there's no real reason or need to develop the property further.
He grimaced.
Trade's down, generally, since the dispute over the Hanth succession started making people jittery. I've got plenty of unused capacity in my Talisberg foundries.
That may be about to change, even without the new artillery, Merlin told him. Hausman sat a bit straighter in his chair, eyebrows arching, and Merlin snorted. Karras is about to experience a period of rapidly growing trade, I suspect, he said. In fact, Master Mikhail, you're going to be a major part of that.
I am I?
Mikhail chuckled and crossed his legs.
I admit I like the sound of that, Sajin Merlin. I've always been partial to that nice, musical sound gold coins make falling into my purse.
There are a couple of new machines I'm hoping you'll introduce for us, Merlin told him. One is called the Cotton Gin, and another is called the Spinning Jenny.
And what do these machines do?
Mikhail asked. The first one removes the seeds from raw cotton and cotton silk without requiring people to pick them out by hand. The spinning jenny is basically a spinning wheel set up with multiple spindles, so one person can spin several yarns at the same time, Merlin said calmly. Mikhail's legs uncrossed, and Merlin smiled as the merchant leaned forward in his chair, his eyes suddenly intent.
You can separate the seeds without hand labor?
The Carisian asked, and Merlin nodded.
What sort of capacity are you talking about?
Mikhail pressed.
And could it separate the seeds from steel thistle?
I don't really know the answer to either of those questions, Merlin admitted. I've never actually built one, or seen one, for that matter. I know the principles around which it works, though, and on the basis of what I do know, I can't see any reason why it shouldn't work for steel thistle as well. Mikhail pursed his lips, his mind racing, and Merlin hid a smile. Cotton silk was very similar to terrestrial cotton, except that the native Seifholdian plant produced a fabric which was even lighter and stronger than cotton, and was widely used for clothing in climates like Caris's. It was expensive, because removing its seeds was even harder than removing them from regular cotton, yet Safehold's weavers had worked with it from the very beginning of the colony. The potentials of steel thistle, another Safeholdian plant, on the other hand, had always tempted and frustrated local textile makers in almost equal measure. Steel thistle looked a lot like branching bamboo, with the same segmented-looking trunks, and it grew even more quickly than the terrestrial plant. It also produced seed pods, which were filled with very fine, very strong fibers, which could be woven into a fabric even stronger than silk. Indeed, stronger than anything old Earth's humanity had been able to produce before the days of synthetic fibers. Unfortunately, the pods also contained very small, very spiny seeds. They were a nightmare to extract by hand, and the tiny wounds the seed's spines inflicted had a nasty habit of turning septic. That was why no one outside Harchong and the Desnarian Empire, which practiced what was for all intents and purposes slave labor, had ever managed to produce useful quantities of woven steel thistle. It also explained the stuff's incredible cost. So if this cotton gin could remove its seeds without the need for hand labor... "Given all of your own experience," Merlin continued, and Mikhail blinked and refocused on him, "I'm sure you'll be able to develop a far more effective version of it than I could. And it occurs to me that Master Hausman would make an excellent partner for you. The two of you are already accustomed to working together, and his foundries already use a lot of water power. His master mechanics could undoubtedly come up with a way to power cotton gins and spinning jennies the same way. And all of his equipment has already been approved by the church." Mikhail and Hausman looked at one another, their eyes brightly speculative, and Merlin smiled. "While you're thinking about that," he added, "why don't the two of you and Master Hausman's artificers spend some time thinking about how to design a powered loom as well? Once you get the cotton gin and spinning jenny up and running, you'll have yarn coming out of your ears. Besides, the Navy's going to need a lot more sailcloth, and I imagine a powered loom would let you manufacture canvas with a tighter weave, don't you think, Master Mikhail?"
"Langhorne," Mikhail muttered. "He's right, Edward. And if this spinning jenny works the way he seems to think it will, especially if you can figure out a way to power it, we can use it for wool and flax as well." He shook himself and looked back at Merlin. "No wonder you're expecting an upturn in trade, Sejin Merlin."
"Shipbuilding, too," Merlin assured them. "For the Navy, of course. But I suspect you're going to see a lot of new merchant ship construction as well, once Sir Dustin and I finish discussing something called a schooner rig. That one I actually have some personal experience with, which is why I'm certain it's going to create quite a sensation when Sir Dustin, and you, of course, Master Hausman, trot it out. It may take a few months for people to realize its advantages, but once they do, you're going to be swamped with orders. I suspect the sudden infusion of capital is going to make the development of a new foundry at Delphac much more feasible."
"And if we're that busy, it'll also explain why I suddenly need to be developing new foundries at all,"
Hausman said enthusiastically.
"And," Mikhail added, "given the fact that all of these new ideas are really coming from you, Sejin Merlin, and from His Majesty, it's only fitting that that sudden infusion of capital should go into building up the Navy."
"The King is considering the establishment of something called a patent office," Merlin told them. "It's something that's going to have to be approached cautiously for a lot of reasons. But if we can get it organized, people who come up with new and better ways to do things will be able to file for a patent on their new ideas. That means they'll own the idea, and that no one else, in Caris at least, can use it without their permission. and usually the payment of a modest fee to the person who created it. At the moment, His Majesty plans for each of you to file patents on the new ideas you introduce as a result of our conferences.
I'm as selfish as the next man, Sir Jin Merlin,
Hausman said, his expression troubled.
But I don't feel comfortable at the thought of owning a... what did you call it? A patent? On an idea you provided.
Master Hausman, Merlin said with a smile, I have absolutely no idea how to turn most of these ideas into practical devices. The cannon, yes, and the new rigging designs I'll be discussing with Sir Dustin, but foundries, textile manufactories, investment arrangements, those are at least as foreign to me as anything I may know could possibly be to you. It's going to require a partnership in every sense of the word for us to make all of this work. So, my thought is that the simplest solution would be for each of you, as patriotic Carisians, to announce that you're assigning half of any patent fees you receive to the crown. That, coupled with the duties the people buying your new goods will be paying, ought to recompense the king quite handily.
And what about you?
Mikhail asked, and Merlin shrugged. A Sejin has little use for worldly wealth, they say. Personally, I've always enjoyed a few minor luxuries, but King Harald is providing me with quite comfortable living quarters, and I expect he'll be happy to provide those minor luxuries if I ask him to. Beyond that, what would I do with money if I had it?
You actually mean that, don't you?
Hausman said, and Merlin nodded. I most certainly do, Master Hausman. Besides, I'm going to be far too busy for the next few years to worry about spending money on anything.
Apparently, Seijin are even more different from other men than I'd always heard,
Mikhail said with a small smile. Then the smile faded, and he nodded solemnly to Merlin.
Nonetheless, Seijin Merlin, whatever else happens, Edward and I, and all of Corris, are going to owe you far more than we could ever pay with mere money. Most of Corris won't know that. We will. For myself, and I feel sure for Edward as well, if we can ever serve you in any way, with gold or steel, you have only to call.
Hausman nodded firmly. I thank you for that, both of you, Merlin said, and meant every word of it. But for now, I'm afraid it's about time for me to meet with Sir Dustin. Prince Caleb, Baron Seamount, and Earl Lockisland are going to be joining the two of us in about another hour. If I could impose upon you, Master Hausman, I would be very grateful if you would join us then as well. There's one point especially I'm going to need your input on.
Oh?
Hausman looked at him for a moment, then snorted suddenly.
Let me guess. It has to do with Dustin's crazy idea about covering the bottoms of all the Navy's ships in copper?
I wouldn't call it a crazy idea, Merlin replied with a smile, but that is what I wanted to discuss.
It's going to cost a fortune,
Hausman objected. It's going to be expensive, true, Merlin agreed. But Sir Dustin is onto something very important here, Master Hausman. Not only will sheathing the ships in copper below the waterline protect them from the borers, but it will cut down enormously on fouling, which means the ships will be faster, more maneuverable, and last a lot longer. Hausman continued to look dubious, and Merlin cocked his head. The way things are now, he said, by the time a galley's been in the water for a month, its hull has already become foul enough to significantly reduce speed and make its rowers work much, much harder, which means that exhaustion sets in sooner, and maneuverability goes down steadily. Now, we're talking about sail-powered ships, not galleys, but the same considerations apply.
All right, Hausman said, a bit grudgingly, and Mikhail grunted a laugh.
Hausman looked at him, and Mikhail shook his head.
Admit it, Edward. Your real problem is, first, that you didn't think of it instead of Dustin,
and second, that you haven't been able to figure out a way to do it without the copper falling right back off."
"Nonsense," Hausman replied.
The denial came out just a bit huffily, Merlin thought, and spoke up quickly. "I think I know how to solve the problem of keeping it on the ships," he said. He had no intention of getting into the explanation of terms like electrolytic solutions and galvanic action between the copper and the iron nails Hausman had been using to attach it. Nor would he have to, once he demonstrated how to avoid it. Of course, coming up with that many copper fastenings to avoid the electrolytic corrosion of dissimilar metals was going to be a problem in its own right, but it would still be simpler than trying to explain the concept of anodes.
"You do?"
Hausman looked at him speculatively, and Merlin nodded. "Yes, but coming up with that much sheet copper, not to mention the fastenings we're going to need, is going to put an even greater demand on your foundry capacity. So I'd be grateful if between now and then you and Master Mikhail could put a little more thought into the possibilities of developing Delphac. It occurs to me that you might consider turning it not simply into a new foundry, but into a shipyard. We'd like to keep anyone else from realizing that we're coppering our hulls. It's probably going to get out eventually, but the longer we can keep that from happening, the better. And if you're going to build a foundry and a shipyard anyway, you might think about adding a textile manufactory as well, if there's enough water power available from the river you mentioned." The two Carizians nodded, and Merlin pushed his chair back, stood, and bowed slightly to them. Then he strode briskly out of the chamber. Hausman and Mikhail had their heads close together before he was completely out the door. October, Year of God, 890. 1. Prince Hector's Palace, Manchir, Coruscant.
"My prince?"
Oscar Mulvane went down on one knee as Prince Hector of Coruscant entered the small private council chamber and crossed to the ornately carved chair at the head of the table. Philip Osgood, the Earl of Corus, followed the prince, seating himself at Hector's left hand. Neither of them said anything for several seconds, and Mulvane reminded himself that wiping sweat from his forehead would be inadvisable. "You may stand," Hector said after a moment, in the melodious tenor which always seemed just a bit odd, coming from one of the most cold-blooded political calculators on the face of the planet. Mulvane obeyed, rising and clasping his hands behind him as he met the eyes of the ruler in whose service he had spied for almost 20 years. Hector hadn't changed a great deal over those 2 decades. The dark brown hair was lightly frosted with silver at the temples. There were a few more wrinkles at the corner of the eyes, and a few strands of white in the neatly trimmed beard. But he was still tall, straight, and broad-shouldered, and unlike the majority of rulers, he continued to work out regularly with his court armsmaster. Beside him, Corus seemed somehow washed out, faded. Unlike his prince, the Earl was fair-haired, and if he was almost as tall as Hector, he lacked the prince's breadth of shoulder and muscularity. There was something about the eyes, too, Mulvane thought, not for the first time. They weren't weaker than Hector's, but they were the eyes of a man who knew he would always be someone else's servant. Which he was, of course. "So, Master Mulvane," the prince said after several more seconds of fresh silence. "What went wrong?"
"My prince," Mulvane said. "I dunno."
He wasn't at all happy about making that admission, but it was far better to be honest and avoid excuses.
"That doesn't seem to speak very well of your sources, Master Mulvane,"
Corus observed with a thin smile. The fact that not even a flicker of annoyance crossed Hector's face as the Earl inserted himself into the conversation told Mulvane quite a lot.
"Perhaps not, my lord," he replied. "But while I make no excuses, I would point out, if I might, that we weren't the only people Wave Thunder's men were after."
"Forgive me if I seem obtuse, but that sounds as if you are making excuses," Corrus remarked.
"Not precisely, my lord."
Mulvane was a bit surprised his own voice sounded as calm as it did.
"What I meant to suggest was that either Wave Thunder's known a great deal more than anyone thought he knew for a very long time, and chosen not to act upon it, or else something radically new has been added to the pot in Corrus. If Wave Thunder did already know everything he finally acted upon, there's no excuse anyone could offer. If, however, some completely new factor has suddenly intruded, there was no way anyone could have predicted it and prepared against it ahead of time."
Corrus grimaced and made a brushing-away gesture with his left hand, but Hector cocked his head and contemplated Mulvane with a slightly more interested eye.
"We have only a fragmentary report from Master Maesan," the prince said after a moment. "It's apparent from what he was able to tell us that something new has indeed been added. The question is, what? And a second question is how you would suggest that whatever it is led Wave Thunder to you."
"My prince,"
Mulvane said, deciding to regard the fact that Hector had chosen to re-enter the conversation personally as a good sign.
"I don't know what Zaspar may have already reported. By the time Lieutenant Mathis and the Francine reached Talisburg and I made contact with him, Zaspar and I had been out of touch for almost 2 5-days. It was clear Wave Thunder's agents were looking for me, and neither of us wanted their hunt for me to lead them to him. Certain elements of the situation became evident only in the last day or so before Lieutenant Mathis sailed for home, however, and Zaspar may not have been aware of them when he wrote his report. I will, of course, tell you anything I can, but if I may, I would like to ask one question first."
Corrus's eyebrows drew down in a frown, but Hector only pursed his lips thoughtfully for a second, then nodded.
"Ask," he said.
"My prince,"
Mulvane gathered his nerve in both hands,
"did you know the Duke of Tirion was working with Prince Narmon?"
Despite the fact that he was the official spymaster for the League of Coruscant, the Earl of Corrus failed to conceal his twitch of surprise. Hector's expression never flickered, but there was something in the depths of those sharp, dark eyes. Silence lingered for perhaps 10 seconds, then the prince shook his head.
"No," he said, "I wasn't aware of that. Why?"
"Because, according to the rumors running around Talisburg just before Lieutenant Mathis and I sailed, Tirion was not only working with Prince Narmon, but was actually the one responsible for the attempt to assassinate Caelan."
"What?"
The single-word question came out calmly, almost conversationally, but there was a flare of genuine surprise in Hector's eyes.
"Obviously, there was no time for me to confirm the stories one way or the other, even if I'd still dared to contact any of my people,"
Mulvane said.
"Nonetheless, I believe them to have been true."
"What stories?"
"Apparently, my prince, Tirion had been working with Narmon for quite some time. While Narmon's man Lahang undoubtedly arranged the actual attempt, the suggestion for it seems to have come from Tirion. It would appear he saw it as a first step in placing himself upon Harald's throne."
"And why?" Hector's eyes were narrow, his expression intense. "Do you believe these stories were accurate?"
"Because I'd already known for over a 5-day that Tirion was dead,"
Mulvane said simply.
"Tirion is dead?"
The question was startled out of Corrus, who glanced instantly and apologetically at Hector. But the prince scarcely seemed to notice as he looked at Mulvane with the closest thing to consternation Mulvane had ever seen from him.
"Yes, my lord."
Mulvane chose to answer Corrus, but his eyes were on Hector.
"That much had leaked out much earlier. So had the fact that he'd been involved in something treasonous. But Wave Thunder and Harald have been remarkably successful at concealing most of the details, presumably while they completed their investigation. It wasn't until after Francine's arrival that I heard the first rumours that he not only was dead, but had been killed by Earl Greyharbor himself.
Corrus's jaw dropped, and Hector sat back in his chair, laying his forearms along the armrests.
"As I'm sure Jaspar did include in his last report to you, my lord," Mulvane continued, "the actual attempt to kill Caleb was frustrated by the intervention of a stranger, a man named Merlin, who apparently claims to be a Sejin. I have no way to judge whether or not he truly is one, but he's obviously a dangerous man with a sword. One of the assassins was captured alive, again, according to the rumours, because of this Merlin. According to one of my contacts inside the palace, the man they took was little more than a common soldier, and one wouldn't have thought one such as he would have had access to any truly important information. Unfortunately for Duke Tyrion, he apparently knew more than anyone believed he did. At any rate, under interrogation, he said something which caused Wavethunder to suspect that Tyrion himself was involved with Narmon in some way. Greyharbor was unwilling to believe such a thing of his son-in-law, not to mention of the king's cousin, but the evidence must have been fairly compelling, whatever it was, because Greyharbor went to personally confront Tyrion. According to most versions of the tale that came to me, he hoped to convince Tyrion to throw himself on Harald's mercy, which suggests that whatever they knew, they didn't begin to suspect the whole. No one I spoke to was quite certain exactly what happened that night, but Greyharbor had gone to Tyrion's townhouse, accompanied by his own personal guardsman and this same Merlin. When he confronted Tyrion, fighting broke out. Greyharbor's guardsman was killed, as were at least 10 or 15 of Tyrion's men, the majority of them apparently, once again by Merlin, and Greyharbor himself killed Tyrion. Langhorn,
Corrus murmured, touching his heart and then his lips.
And you believe these stories were accurate? Hector asked intently.
My prince, they must have been,
Mulvane said simply.
There's no question that Greyharbor killed Tyrion. The palace itself confirmed that the afternoon before we sailed, and the man was King Harald's cousin, fourth in line for the throne itself. If there were any question in Harald's mind of Tyrion's guilt, Greyharbor would, at the very least, have been stripped of his offices and imprisoned while the facts were investigated. None of that's happened, and this so-called Sejin is still an honoured guest in Harald's palace. Indeed, he's become a member of the Royal Guard, and has been assigned as Caleb's personal guardsman, despite his involvement in whatever happened.
Hector nodded slowly, obviously considering Mulvane's logic carefully. Then he once again cocked his head to one side.
Is it your opinion that whatever happened to Tyrion somehow explains what happened to you?
I don't know, my prince. On the one hand, there was no connection between Jasper or me and the assassination attempt. On the other hand, both of us knew Lahang was Narmon's man in Telisburg. I would say it's quite probable that, in turn, he knew I was one of your agents, and what he knew might have been passed on to Tyrion or one of his own senior agents. It's obvious Greyharbor must have gotten something out of Tyrion before the Duke was killed, and more than just confirmation of his involvement in the assassination attempt, I suspect. Lahang was either killed or arrested that very same night. No one's certain which, he simply disappeared. My own belief is that he was taken and interrogated, probably quite rigorously in light of the attempt to kill Caleb.
And you believe this because?
Because of the way Wavethunder and his agents have devastated Narmon's network in Curry since his disappearance, my prince. Dozens of his senior people have been arrested, including several prominent Carisian merchants and more than a few members of the nobility. Some of them had already been executed before I left Telisburg, and there were scores of additional arrests. You know Harald's reputation, and Wavethunder's. They seldom arrest anyone unless they're completely confident of their evidence. These arrests, and especially the executions, would seem to me a clear indication that somebody in Narmon's employ who knew all the important details about his network talked. The only two candidates I can see would be Tyrion, who I doubt had time to reveal that much detailed information before he was killed, or Lahang himself.
And you believe whoever it was who talked also knew about your own activities?
Hector asked.
"It's the only explanation I've been able to think of, my prince," Mulvane said frankly. "So far as I'm aware, they have no suspicion at all of Jasper. And also, so far as I'm aware, although they've issued warrants for my own arrest, they haven't arrested any of the sources and contacts I've cultivated. I suppose it's possible they're leaving those contacts alone, waiting to see who replaces me, but I believe it's more likely that someone in Narman's organization who'd become aware of my activities mentioned my name under interrogation. Wave Thunder knows enough to suspect me. I doubt he knows about the rest of our organization in Kurris, or he would have moved against more of our agents, not me alone.
I see. Hector leaned further back in his chair, his expression thoughtful. He sat that way for at least 3 full minutes, then nodded. It may be you're correct in your assumptions, he said at last. It's also possible, of course, that you aren't. However, there's no need to act hastily. He picked up a small silver bell and shook it. Its voice was clear and sweet, and the chamber door opened almost instantly.
"Yes, my prince,"
a captain in the uniform of Hector's personal guard said. "Escort this man back to his quarters, captain," the prince said. "See to it that he's treated well and with respect, and that any of his reasonable needs and desires are met. Is that understood?"
"It is, my prince."
"Good." Hector looked back at Mulvane. "At the moment, I'm very much inclined to believe that whatever happened wasn't your fault, and that your service there was as loyal and efficient as it's always proved in the past. Until I can be certain of that, however, precautions must be taken."
"Of course, my prince."
"Good," Hector said again, and made a small waving gesture with his right hand. The guard captain bowed respectfully to Mulvane, holding the door open for him, and Mulvane stepped out of the chamber into the hall beyond with a cautious sense of optimism. "What do you think?" Prince Hector asked, glancing at Earl Corus as the door closed behind Mulvane and the guard captain.
"I think we don't have any independent information to confirm a single thing he said, sire," Corus replied after a moment.
"So you think he's lying?"
"I didn't say that, sire,"
the Earl said with a calm self-confidence, rather at odds with the attitude he normally projected in Hector's presence when anyone else was present.
"What I said is that we don't have any independent corroboration, and we don't. It's certainly possible he is lying. The notion that his organization was broken through some sort of fluke circumstance beyond anyone's control would be one way to cover his ass, after all. But I don't know that he is. I'm simply not prepared to automatically assume he isn't. And even if he is, it doesn't necessarily follow that his analysis of what happened is correct."
"I think," Hector said after a long, thoughtful moment, "that I believe him. We didn't pick fools to send to Tellisburg, and only a fool would spin a tale like that, knowing that sooner or later we'd find out he'd lied to us. And I suspect his theory about what happened is also substantially accurate." The prince pushed back his chair, stood, and crossed to the chamber window. It was a wide window, set into a thick wall of heat-shedding stone, and it was also open to any breath of breeze, for Coruscant's capital of Manchir was closer to the equator even than Tellisburg, and the midday sun was hot and high overhead. He leaned on the sill, gazing out over the brilliant tropical flowers of his palace gardens, listening to the occasional twitter of birdsong from the flocks of songbirds maintained in the palace aviary. "Narman is a fool," he said quietly, with a dispassion which might have fooled most people, but did not fool Philip Osgood. "Langhorne knows Tomas is no genius, but he knows better than to cross me. And he's not a total idiot, either. Narman, on the other hand, can give a very convincing imitation of one. We've always known that. But one works with the tools one has, and, to be honest, I'm afraid, I never realized just how big a fool he is."
We already knew his people were involved in the assassination attempt, sire,
Corrus pointed out, and Hector nodded, never looking away from the gardens beyond the window.
Agreed. But to have involved himself with Tyrion was incredibly stupid. Eventually, one of them would have had to turn on the other. And to let himself be talked into attempting to assassinate Caelob...
The prince turned back to face Corrus at last, shaking his head, his square jaw tight with anger.
If the attempt had succeeded, it would only have meant Tyrion would betray him even sooner. Surely even he should have recognized that.
I agree Narmon isn't especially bright, sire. At the same time, he has displayed a certain ruthlessness about disposing of tools which become liabilities. I wouldn't be surprised to discover that he'd placed someone with a knife close to Tyrion as an insurance policy.
You're probably right.
Hector sounded as if he were conceding the possibility considerably against his will, but then he shrugged and shook his head angrily.
Even assuming you are, however, any insurance policy he had obviously failed, didn't it? And it would appear from what Mulvane has to say that Harald is reacting very much as I would have anticipated. This idiot attempt must have cost Narmon the better part of 10 years of building up his own network in Karis, not to mention the effect it's having on our own efforts. And I'm afraid the possibility Mulvane raised, that they do know the identities of at least some of his agents, and Wave Thunder is simply choosing to leave them in position and watch them now that their master's had to flee for his life, also has to be very seriously considered.
He glanced back out the window again for a moment, then walked back across to his chair and sat down once more.
And, he continued more grimly, if Harald chooses to view this direct attack on the monarchy as an act of war, he may not stop with Narmon's spies.
Do you really think that's likely, sire?
I don't know.
Hector drummed the fingers of one hand on the table.
Everyone knows how he dotes on Caelob and his other children. Obviously, from what he's already done, he doesn't take this little affair lightly. And if he's got sufficient solid evidence, and if he chooses to treat this as an act of war, Narmon may suddenly find the Carisian navy sailing into Erester Bay. At which point we'll have to decide whether to support the idiot, which, by the way, will also associate us with the assassination attempt itself, at least after the fact, or else see a major component of our master plan go out from under us.
Corrus considered the prince's words thoughtfully, eyes hooded.
I think, sire, he said finally, that if Harald were likely to take direct military action, he'd already have taken it. Karis has enough galleys in permanent commission to annihilate Narmon's entire fleet in an afternoon, without our support, and Harald wouldn't even give him the time to even try to activate his alliances with us.
Maybe he would, and maybe he wouldn't, Hector said. Harald has to be a bit cautious himself, you know. He's not particularly popular in Zion or in the Temple, and he knows it.
Besides, everyone knows Narmon, and I, of course, backed Montale against Bregart in Harnth. There are those in the Temple like Clintan and the rest of the Group of Four who might choose to interpret any action he takes against Narmon as retribution for that. So he's unlikely to launch any quick attacks without first establishing with very convincing evidence that he's completely justified.
Corrus nodded.
You may well be very right about that, sire. If so, how do we proceed?
We protest our innocence, if he tries to associate us with Narmon's attack.
Hector smiled thinly.
And we'll actually be telling the truth for a change. That should be a novel experience. And I think we ought to invite several of the more important of our other nobles to a personal meeting, without mentioning it to Narmon.
I need to be certain they understand what we're doing, or as much of it as they need to know about at any rate. And I want Tomas here, where I can look him in the eye.
Sire?
Chorus's eyebrows arched.
Do you think Tomas is thinking about climbing into bed with Naaman?
No, Hector said slowly. Not that. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if Naaman isn't trying to convince him to. It would be like Naaman to try to weaken my authority here in the League in order to increase his own bargaining strength. I don't think Tomas is stupid enough to fall for it, but I need to be sure.
And if Naaman learns the two of you have met separately, sire, and that he wasn't invited to send a representative to any of your meetings?
It might not be a bad thing if he did. Hector smiled coldly, his eyes bleak. First, Tomas is one of the highest-ranked nobles in the League, and Emerald isn't even a League member. Naaman has no right to a seat at our table, unless we invite him to join us. And second, it would please me to make the fool sweat a little. Besides, Hector snorted, given his part in the assassination plot, he can hardly hope to switch sides and betray us to Harald, even if we do hurt his feelings, now can he? I suppose not, Chorus conceded with a thin smile of his own. In the meantime, we should probably decide what steps we can take to ratchet up the pressure on Karis while Harald's still distracted by his concentration on Emerald. And of course, the prince added a touch bitterly, to keep ourselves occupied while we recover from the damage Naaman's little fiasco's done to our own organization in Tellisburg.
What sort of steps did you have in mind, sire?
I don't know that we have all that many opportunities for direct action, Hector admitted, and even if we did, I might avoid them for now. After all, it was Naaman's notion of direct action that created this mess in the first place. But it occurs to me that one thing we definitely ought to do is immediately step up our efforts to influence the Council of Vicars.
Risky, sire, Chorus observed.
Hector's eyes flashed, but he took the Earl's caution far more calmly than most of his courtiers would have expected. I know it is, he agreed after a second or two, but I think riskier for Harald than for us. He's got that damned college of his hanging around his neck. With a little luck, we may be able to convince the group of four to turn it into an executioner's halter. Chorus nodded, but the gesture expressed more acceptance than agreement, and Hector knew why. Coruscant was even farther from the temple than Karis, and the same automatic suspicion that attached to Karis in the church's eyes also attached to Coruscant. But Hector had been very careful to do absolutely nothing to encourage that suspicion. Whereas Harald's support for his father's royal college and for the social policies his great-grandfather had set in motion did the reverse. And Hector and Naaman between them had spread a great deal more gold around a great many more hands in the temple than Harald had. Still, Chorus had always been rather more ambivalent than his prince about playing the temple card.
"What do you make of this Merlin of Mulvain, sire?"
the Earl asked, and Hector smiled thinly at the tactful change of subject. "At the moment, not very much," he said. "I don't doubt the fellow really is good with a sword, but it seems fairly evident from what happened to Naaman's organization in Karis that it wouldn't have taken a genius, or a Seijin, assuming they actually exist outside the old fables, to penetrate it. It sounds like he stumbled over something that gave away the attempt on Caleb, and he's probably been riding it for all it's worth ever since."
"An adventurer, then, you think, sire?"
"I think that's the most likely explanation," Hector agreed. "At the same time," he went on a bit grudgingly, "Harald, unlike Naaman, is no fool. Given the fact that the man clearly saved or helped save his son's life, I'd expect a man like Harald to treat the fellow as an honored guest. Probably find him some fairly comfortable slot at court for the rest of his life, for that matter, which is what this personal guardsman business sounds like. But if this Merlin steps into the inner circle of Harald's advisers, then I'll be tempted to believe there's more to him than just an adventurer.
Should we take steps to remove him, sire?
After the way Narmon bungled the attempt on Caleb? Hector shook his head with a hard, sharp crack of laughter. The last thing we need is to get our people, assuming we still have any people in Telesburg by this time, of course, involved in a second assassination. If it worked, Harald would probably suspect Narmon, but we've just had rather convincing evidence that assassinations don't always work out as planned, haven't we?
I suppose we have at that, sire,
Corrus conceded with another thin smile. No, Hector said. I think we'll wait a while before we decide to have the good Sejin eliminated. Unless he begins to make himself a significant threat, there are far better targets for us to expend our effort upon. 2. The Schooner Dawn, off Helen Island.
Well, Captain Rowan, what do you think now?
Merlin had to shout to make himself heard over the rushing sound of wind and water. Seagulls and sea wyverns swirled in raucous clouds of white feathers and glistening many-hued hide under the brilliant springtime sun. They dipped and dove about the 50-foot twin-masted schooner Dawn as she drove through the brilliant blue water of South Howell Bay in explosions of scattered rainbow-hued spray and left a straight white wake behind her. Dawn was the first schooner ever seen on Safehold. Sir Dustin Oliver was the official designer of the rig, and officially Merlin was simply a passenger aboard her. But Horace Rowan, the skipper of Oliver's personal yacht, the Agnet, was one of the small but steadily growing handful of people who'd had to be told at least part of the truth about the sudden flood of new innovations. Rowan knew who'd really come up with the converted coaster's new sail plan, and despite his faith in his patron, he'd been openly skeptical about Merlin's claims. That was obviously changing. The captain, a stocky, balding man with a fringe of gray hair around a bare, sun-bronzed scalp and a spectacularly weathered face, stood on the schooner's short, cramped quarterdeck, staring in something very like disbelief at the masthead pendant which showed the wind's direction. Dawn was sailing close-hauled on the port tack. In itself, that was nothing particularly unique, but as she leaned stiffly to starboard under the press of her brand-new, snowy-white canvas, she was doing it better than anyone else had ever dreamed of. Even the best square-rigged sail plans yet devised on Safehold were little more weatherly than Columbus's ships had been in 1492, and their version of close-hauled was quite different from Dawn's. The galleons which plied Safehold seas could steer no closer than within 70 degrees of directly into the wind, what Nemu Albin would have called little better than a close reach under even ideal conditions. Indeed, a more realistic figure would have been closer to 80 degrees, and most Safeholdian sailing masters would have settled for that without complaint. But Dawn was sailing within just under 50 degrees of the true wind. Even that was far from spectacular by the standards of the sailing yachts Nemu had known on Old Earth saltwater, but Dawn had been converted from a typical Howell Bay coaster. She was relatively shoal-hulled and broad-beamed, without the fin keel or centerboard of one of those yachts. Merlin and Sir Dustin had added lee boards to give her better hydrodynamics, but it was an awkward makeshift fix,
and the schooner rig itself was inherently less weatherly than the sloops or yawls Nemu had once sailed for recreation. Yet however disappointed Nemu Alban might have been by Dawn's performance in those long-ago days on Old Earth's North Sea, Merlin was delighted, and Rowan was astounded. No ship he'd ever seen could have matched that performance, and if 20 or 30 degrees might not have sounded like all that much to a landsman, it meant a great deal to an experienced seaman. The only way for a sail-powered vessel to travel to windward was to beat, to sail as close-hauled as possible, and swing back and forth across the wind. At the best of times, it was a slow, laborious, hideously inefficient business compared to sailing with or on the wind, or to what a powered vessel could have accomplished, or, for that matter, a galley, while her rower's endurance lasted. Tacking, which was essentially a matter of turning the ship across the wind, was the more efficient way of going about it, but that required the vessel doing the tacking to maintain the forward speed and steerage way long enough to swing across the eye of the wind. Given how far a typical Safeholdian square rigger had to turn to swing across the wind, that was usually a problematic venture at the best of times. Far more frequently, especially in moderate or light winds, a current generation square rigger had to wear ship instead, turning downwind, away from the direction it actually wanted to go, through an effective arc of well over 200 degrees, until it could settle onto its new heading. In the process, it had to give up a heartbreaking amount of hard-won progress as the wind pushed it to leeward during the maneuver. It was hardly surprising that tacking was the preferred technique, but even there the square rigger had to swing through a total heading change of 140 degrees across the wind each time it tacked. Dawn's total heading change, on the other hand, would be little more than 90 degrees. That left her a much shorter no-sail zone to cross, and her basic rig was what a sailor would have called much faster in the stays than any Safeholdian square rigger. Which, basically, simply meant she came about more rapidly, and her sails could be reset on the new tack much more quickly. Even completely ignoring the fact that she could get around onto the new tack so much more speedily, Dawn's 20-degree advantage over the very best Safeholdian square rigger ever built, it was actually closer to 25 degrees, meant that to reach a point 60 miles directly to windward of her start position, all other things being equal, she would have to sail the next best thing to 90 miles, while the square rigger would have to travel 180. And that was assuming the square rigger was able to tack at all, instead of wearing. Unlike pre-metric Old Earth, Safehold's sea miles and land miles were the same length, which meant that if both Dawn and the square rigger were traveling at speeds of 6 knots, Dawn would make the 60 miles dead to windward in 15 hours, while the square rigger would require 30. Over a voyage of several hundred or even thousands of miles, that would represent a significantly shorter overall voyage time. It also meant the square rigger could never catch the little schooner in a chase to windward, which would be a handy insurance policy against pirates. By the same token, the square rigger couldn't evade the schooner to windward, which had interesting implications for potential warships or pirates. It was obvious to Merlin, and, he felt sure, to Horace Rowan, that Dawn's present sail plan was far from perfectly balanced, and she required far more lee helm than she should have to hold her present course. But no one on Safehold had any notion of how to make proper displacement and stability calculations, far less how to calculate appropriate sail areas. Merlin had access to the necessary formulas, thanks to the library computer tucked away in Nemu's cave, but despite Nemu's yachting experience, he had only the most limited possible practical experience in applying them. More to the point, there was no way he could possibly hand something like that over to Olivier or Razier Moklin without raising all sorts of questions none of them would have wanted answered. But, imperfect or not, it was doing its job, and a designer with Olivier's years of experience would soon hit upon a workable rule of thumb for designing proper sail plans for the new rig. Which, Merlin thought with a smile, will only make Dawn's successors perform even better. Rowan was still staring up at the masthead pendant. Obviously, he hadn't heard a word Merlin had said, so Merlin thumped him on the shoulder. The Carisian jerked, then turned his head quickly with a questioning expression. "I asked what you think now," Merlin repeated loudly, and Rowan grinned hugely.
"I think I want one of my very own," he half-shouted back. "And so will everyone else who sees this. Langhorne, just look at that heading. And the reduction in sail handlers is going to be another big advantage for your typical clutch-fisted ship owner."
"Agreed," Merlin nodded vigorously. Any square rigger was a manpower-intensive proposition, and a schooner-rigged vessel like Dawn required a much smaller crew. Conversely, the square rigger could carry an enormous sail area, and because her sails tended to be individually smaller in proportion to her total sail plan, she could absorb more damage aloft than most schooner rigs could.
"Sir Dustin tells me he wants Agnet re-rigged too,"
Rowan continued, cocking an eyebrow at Merlin, and Merlin chuckled. "Dawn's an experiment, Captain. Now that Sir Dustin has his hand in, as it were, he's ready to do it right with Agnet. The fact that he designed her himself should give him a much better feel for modifying her rig, too. And then, of course, he's going to be inviting potential ship buyers aboard for a little cruise outside the Telesburg breakwater, just as a purely social occasion, of course."
"Oh, of course,"
Rowan agreed with a deep, rolling belly laugh.
"He's been using that ship for purely social occasions like that for as long as I've captained her for him. But this..."
He reached out and stroked the quarterdeck rail almost reverently, gazing back up at the masthead pendant and the set of the sails once again, then shook his head and looked back at Merlin.
"I think I'd best be getting a feel for the way she handles Lieutenant Athrawes."
It was technically a statement, but actually a request, a recognition that Dawn was truly Merlin's ship, and that Merlin would be his real tutor over the next few days.
"I think that's an excellent idea, Captain," Merlin agreed, and hid another mental smile.
I wonder how Sir Dustin would react if he knew the real reason I argued in favor of a pure fore-and-aft rig for our prototype. Despite himself, he laughed out loud, and Rowan looked at him with an interrogatory expression. But Merlin only shook his head. Eventually, he was certain, the topsail schooner would emerge as the rig of choice. With the addition of square-rigged topsails on both masts, and even a square-rigged course on the foremast, it was probably the most powerful two-masted schooner rig ever devised. It could be driven harder and faster on the wind without sacrificing a great deal of its weatherliness, which would make it highly attractive to anyone looking for speedy passages, although the manpower demands would rise. But Merlin had no more intention of explaining to Rowan than to Sir Dustin Oliver that the fellow responsible for showing them this marvelous new rig had absolutely no idea how to manage a square rigger. That probably wouldn't have done a lot for their confidence in my suggestions, Merlin thought sardonically, then gave himself a mental shake and grinned at Rowan. "Why don't you step over here and take the helm yourself for a few minutes, Captain Rowan?" he invited.
November, Year of God, 890. 1. Archbishop Erech's quarters, City of Zion.
"Good morning, Erech."
Erech Dinis sat a bit straighter in the comfortable armchair,
Well, the chair would have been comfortable, if anything could have been. It was heavily upholstered, the cushions deep enough that it took Dennis's valet and a temple guardsman to boost him out of it when it was time to rise. Unfortunately, with a leg broken in 3 places and a shoulder broken in at least 2, there was no such thing as a comfortable place to sit. At the moment, however, that was definitely in 3rd or 4th place amongst his concerns as he found himself confronting a man in the unadorned orange priest's cap of a vicar.
"Good morning, Your Grace," he said. "Forgive my appearance. I wasn't expecting a visitor this morning."
"I'm aware of that," Vicar Zomsen Trenaire said with a gentle smile. "I was in the vicinity on another matter, however, and I thought I'd just drop in and see how you were doing."
Dennis nodded with a smile of his own, although he was perfectly well aware that Trenaire intended for him to realize he'd just been lied to. The Chancellor of the Council of Vicars didn't just happen to drop in on a mere archbishop, especially not at this time of the year, when the visit required the vicar in question to leave the mystically heated precincts of his luxurious personal quarters in the temple itself.
"May I?"
Trenaire gestured gracefully at another chair in Dennis's sitting room, the sapphire ring of his office flashing in the lamplight, and the archbishop gave himself a shake.
"Please be seated, Your Grace," he said hastily, "and please forgive my lack of manners as well. I truly wasn't expecting you, and I'm afraid the healers are still prescribing poppy juice."
"Don't concern yourself about it," Trenaire said graciously. "After a fall such as yours, we're indeed fortunate your injuries weren't even more severe."
"I appreciate your understanding, Your Grace."
Dennis waited while Trenaire settled himself into the indicated chair. The Chancellor was taller than Dennis, leaner, with an angular face, deep, intelligent eyes, and a closely trimmed beard. He wore the orange cassock of his exalted rank, badged with the blue quill sigil of the Order of Chihiro, and the hem of his cassock was damp with melted snow to above mid-calf.
"May I offer you something to drink, Your Grace?"
Dennis asked, once the Chancellor had seated himself and extended his hands to the coal fire crackling cheerfully on the hearth.
"Some hot chocolate would be most welcome on a day like this,"
Trenaire agreed, and Dennis nodded to his valet, who scurried off to deal with the request.
"I haven't been out myself, of course, Your Grace," Dennis said, "but people tell me the weather's unusually severe this year."
"They tell you correctly, Eric."
Trenaire chuckled and shook his head.
"The snow's over 3 feet deep out there, and it's only November, not even full winter yet. I've seldom seen so many snowfalls so early in the season, and," his expression turned graver, "I'm afraid it's had a predictable effect on the semaphore."
Dennis nodded glumly. The greatest single weakness of the church's semaphore system was that it was visibility limited. Darkness, snow, rain, fog, any and all of them could and did shut down Mother Church's communications relays. There was a system to send signals through simple darkness, but it was less reliable, more vulnerable to errors in transcription at the various semaphore stations, and much slower, and it still couldn't cope with typical winter weather's decreased visibility.
"It's always that way, isn't it, Your Grace?"
he said after a moment, with an air of resignation.
"Yes, yes, it is. Those in other lands who envy us our high office seldom think about the penance we pay each winter here in Zion and the Temple. Although," Trenaire allowed himself a chuckle, which struck Dennis's ear as not quite truly spontaneous, "you yourself have been spared that particular penance for the past several years, haven't you?"
"I suppose I have,"
Dennis replied, just a bit slowly, while his poppy-fumed brain raced.
"And,"
he acknowledged with a chuckle of his own,
"I suppose I ought to admit I've scheduled my pastoral visits expressly to avoid winter here in Zion, Your Grace."
"I'm not surprised," Trenaire said dryly, then snorted. "Anyone but a village idiot would schedule them that way, if he had the option."
"I certainly would." "Well, perhaps this—"
Dennis's left hand indicated the plaster the bone-setter had used to immobilize his shattered right leg and the sling supporting his right arm.
"Is all of those years of missed penances catching up with me at last?"
He managed to keep his voice almost normal, but it was difficult. The pain was bad enough, but the healers had already warned him he would require a cane, at best, for his right leg would never be the same again.
"Oh, I doubt that."
Trinair spoke in a voice so deliberately jovial that Dennis suspected the vicar had already heard the same healer's reports.
"None of us is perfect, Erech, but I rather doubt you could be imperfect enough to have laid up a debt quite that severe. On the other hand," the Chancellor's eyes sharpened, "it may, perhaps, be unfortunate that you suffered your accident at this particular time."
"Your Grace?"
Dennis felt his own eyes narrow slightly as he realized Trinair was finally approaching the true point of his visit.
"I'm sure that you're aware that certain concerns have been expressed about Caris," the Chancellor said.
He held Dennis's gaze until the Archbishop nodded.
"I am, Your Grace. Indeed, I've passed those concerns on to Bishop Executor Gerald and Father Pater, and I'd intended to devote quite a bit of my own attention to them while I was in Tellisburg. Now, though..."
His left hand indicated the heavy weight of plaster once again, and his left shoulder shrugged.
"I understand, of course."
Trinair leaned forward to pat Dennis lightly on his good knee, then straightened once more as the valet returned with an exquisitely glazed cup of tissue-thin Harchong porcelain filled with steaming hot chocolate. The Chancellor accepted the cup with a murmur of thanks, and sipped deeply and appreciatively, while the valet set the matching chocolate pot and a second cup on the small table between him and Dennis. The valet raised one eyebrow, indicating the unused cup, but the Archbishop shook his head slightly. The valet bowed in acknowledgment, and withdrew as silently as he had arrived.
"I understand, we all understand, why your usual pastoral visit had to be cancelled this year," the Chancellor resumed after a moment. "It's regrettable, naturally, but given the nature and extent of your injuries, it was also unavoidable."
"I appreciate your understanding, Your Grace. I'd be less than honest, however, if I didn't say I would far rather be in Tellisburg right now than here."
He waved at the sitting-room window. The glass was well sealed into its frame, and the cozy sitting room was free of any of the icy drafts which plagued so many homes here in Zion, yet the window pane was heavily frosted, despite the fire on the hearth. Elsewhere in the city, he knew, people less fortunate than he were huddled around any source of heat they could find, and fall and winter always produced hunger as well. Ships could still make it across Lake Pei, with food from the huge granaries and farms in the southern temple lands, but eventually that route, too, would be closed. The city would become totally dependent upon its own granaries and storehouses, and somehow, huge as those were, they always ran short before spring in a city this size. When the present snow melted or was removed, the inevitable bodies would be found where the combination of cold, hunger, and lack of shelter had overtaken the most vulnerable of the city's poor.
"And I," Trinair said, his eyes very level, "would be less than honest if I didn't say I would far rather have you there than here at this moment as well."
"Your Grace, forgive me, but I believe you didn't just happen to drop in on me this morning. I'm deeply honored by your visit, of course, but I can't avoid the suspicion that you have something rather more serious than the weather on your mind."
"I suppose I was guilty of a little white lie," Trinair agreed with a smile.
He sipped more hot chocolate for a moment, then lowered the cup.
"I did have other business in the city today. That much was quite true, Erech. But you're right. I do have certain concerns of my own which I wish to bring to your attention."
"Of course, Your Grace. Please tell me how I can serve you and the church."
Dennis heard the edge of wariness in his own voice, but Trinair ignored it. No doubt the Chancellor was accustomed to that reaction. as the acknowledged senior member of the vicars known, unofficially, of course, as the Group of Four, he was the single most powerful man in the entire temple. Everyone knew Grand Vicar Eric XVII had been elevated to the Grand Vicarate only because Trenaire had been too busy to seek the throne of Langhorne for himself. Nor had there been any reason he had to. Eric XVII was little more than a figurehead, completely dominated by Trenaire and the Grand Inquisitor, the dominant members of the Group of Four. It was said, very quietly, with carefully hidden snickers, that the Grand Vicar routinely demonstrated his independence of Trenaire's direction by choosing which pair of shoes he would wear. "No one is dissatisfied with the service you've already rendered, Eric," Trenaire said in reassuring tones. "However, as I'm sure you're aware, many members of the Council have felt increasingly uneasy over Caris's growing wealth and influence for quite some time. There are those persistent rumours that the kingdom is dabbling in proscribed techniques and knowledge, and the equally persistent rumours that Harald and his ministers have succeeded in evading their rightful tithes. Then there was that matter of the dispute over Hanf, and, of course, there's always that Royal College of Harald's." The Chancellor shook his head, his expression pensive, and Dinis drew a deep, surreptitious breath.
"Your Grace," he began, "I realize the rumors and accounts of which you've spoken have to be weighed and considered carefully. However, I've made all of Bishop Executor Gerald's and Father Pater's reports available to the Council, and my own observations on my past pastoral visits have been that—"
"Eric," Trenaire interrupted him, raising one hand and shaking his head with a slight, crooked smile, and the Archbishop paused.
"No one's accusing you or Bishop Executor Gerald of any wrongdoing or inattention to your responsibilities. I've personally read many of your reports, and I've reviewed other sources of information. I trust your intelligence and your attention to the duties of your archbishopric, and I believe your observations have been substantially accurate in the past."
"Thank you, Your Grace," Dinis said into the silence as Trenaire paused. "I appreciate that."
"It's no more than your due," Trenaire assured him. But then the Chancellor continued gravely. "However, the reports we've been receiving over the past months are different from earlier ones. They appear to be coming from many additional sources, and too many of them agree in form and content."
"I've fallen somewhat behind in my own correspondence over the past few 5 days, Your Grace," Dinis said slowly, cautiously. "Has there been some additional change in that time period?"
"To some extent, there has," Trenaire confirmed. Dinis sat up straighter, wincing at the pain of his injudicious movement, and Trenaire shook his head quickly. "It's more a matter of volume than changes in content, Eric," he said. "And, to be fair, I think it's entirely possible the seasonal loss of the semaphore has all of us in the temple paying more attention to past correspondence than we might otherwise have done. After all," he smiled ruefully, "it's not as if there's a great deal of new correspondence to distract us from our chilblains." Dinis chuckled dutifully, but his eyes remained serious, and Trenaire shrugged. "I've also read Father Pater's reports on all of these new innovations coming out of Caris, as have Vicar Jasper and several other members of the Council. While Father Pater appears to be comporting himself in his usual conscientious and hard-working fashion, Vicar Jasper isn't entirely satisfied with all of his conclusions." Dinis felt genuine alarm. He tried to keep it from getting as far as his expression, but it was obvious he hadn't completely succeeded in the effort, and he cursed the befuddling effect of the poppy juice. "No one is arguing that we have a genuine infraction of the prescriptions, Eric," Trenaire said soothingly. But any reassuring effect was wiped away by his next words. "Yet, at least. There's some decided concern about where your Carisians may end up if they continue along this road, however.
Your Grace, I assure you that as soon as I'm fit to travel, I'll...
Erake, Erake!
Trenaire shook his head.
No one expects you to leap up out of your sick bed and go gallivanting off to Caris through the middle of a haven winter. As I say, we've seen no evidence that the prescriptions have already been violated. Our concerns are for the future, and I'm sure there's no need for you to slog off through the snow to deal with them at this time. We would like you to schedule your next pastoral visit for as early in the year as possible, but no one suggested packing you off to your archbishopric before the ice melts in Sing Wu's passage in the spring.
Thank you, Your Grace. I appreciate that. And, of course, I'll arrange to make the journey as soon as practical.
Good. In the meantime, however, you need to be aware of how the council is thinking.
Trenaire said more gravely.
Just last night, Vicar Jasper, Vicar Robert, Vicar Elaine and I were discussing this very point at an informal little dinner.
Despite the sitting room's warmth, Dinis felt the marrow of his bones try to freeze. Jasper Clinton was the Grand Inquisitor. Robert Ducairne was the Church's Treasurer General. Elaine Maguire was the Church's Captain General, and Trenaire himself was the Council's Chancellor, which meant Trenaire's informal little dinner had actually been a working session of the Group of Four. All of the Group of Four.
The problem, Erek, Trenaire said in that same grave tone, is that whether Harald of Caris intends it that way or not, his kingdom has the potential to become a serious threat. Whatever Father Pater may be reporting about their current innovations, the sheer pace of the changes they're introducing is dangerous. We have many reports, not all admittedly from impartial sources, that the danger we fear in this regard may well be closer at hand than we'd originally thought. The writ itself teaches that change begets change, after all, and that it is in times of change that Mother Church must be most watchful. Yet, even leaving that issue aside for the moment, there are other issues. Issues which affect the Church's power in the secular world as well. I realize Mother Church and we who serve her are supposed to be above the concerns of this world, but you know as well as I do that it's necessary sometimes for God's Church to have the power to act decisively in this world in order to protect men's souls in the next. Caris has grown too wealthy. Its ships travel too broadly, and its ideas spread too widely. Other nations will be quick to adopt Carisian innovations if they appear to offer significant advantages. If that happens, then our concerns about the possible destination to which Caris's taste for new things may lead will perforce spread to all of those other nations as well. And we must not forget Caris's social restiveness. That, too, is being exported aboard its ships. When other kingdoms see the wealth which Caris has attained, it would be strange indeed if they weren't tempted to follow in Caris's wake. And, as your own reports have made evident,
Trenaire's gaze bored into Dinis's eyes,
King Harald is a stubborn man. As witness his insistence on naming his own man Bishop of Tellisburg. A king whose stubbornness, I fear, makes him altogether too likely to rule himself and his kingdom by his own judgment, even if that judgment conflicts with that of Mother Church.
Silence hovered for endless seconds, broken only by the whine of wind outside the window and the crackle of coal on the hearth.
Your Grace, Dinis said finally, I thank you for bringing the Council's concerns to my attention. I understand the reasons for them, I believe, but I beg you and the other vicars not to rush to judgment. Whatever else Caris may be, it's only a single kingdom. Despite the size of its merchant fleet and its navy, it's basically a small land with only a small population. Surely any danger it may represent isn't so pressing that we can't dispel it by taking timely action against it.
I hope and believe you're right, Erek, Trenaire said after a moment. But remember,
The Archangel Pasquale teaches us corruption can spread from even a tiny wound if it isn't properly cleansed and purified. It's not the individual size and strength of Charis that gives us concern. It's what may grow and spread from it in the fullness of time. And, to be frank, from my own perspective, the possibility that the fundamental defiance of Charis's attitude may combine with that of Siddermark. Dennis had begun to open his mouth once more, but he closed it abruptly. So that was it, for Trenaire, at least. For the past 5 decades, the princes of the Church had been increasingly concerned over the Republic of Siddermark's growing power. The Republic dominated the eastern third of the continent of Haven, and while it was less populous than the Harchong Empire, its infantry were a terrifying force on the field of battle. And unlike the Harchongese or the Desneri, the Republic's highest offices were elective, not purely hereditary. The Republic was separated from the Temple Lands by the so-called border states, which stretched almost 2,500 miles from Sing Wu's passage in the north to the Gulf of Dolar in the south. At their southern end, the border states provided a buffer almost 1,300 miles across. But in the extreme north, northeast of the Mountains of Light, along the southern edge of Sing Wu's passage, the Republic's provinces of Tarika and Iceland actually shared a common border with the Temple Lands. And the Republic of Siddermark, unlike the Kingdom of Charis, had the population and the army to pose a genuine threat to the Temple Lands' security. The likelihood that the Republic would be mad enough to actually challenge Mother Church might not be very great, but it wasn't one that Church's great magnates were prepared to ignore either. That was one reason Trenaire and his predecessors as Chancellor had played the Kingdom of Dolar and the Desnarian Empire off against the Republic for the past 30 years. But if Charis's wealth and naval power were to suddenly find themselves allied with the matchless pikemen of Siddermark, the counterpoised tensions the Church had arranged in Haven might find themselves abruptly destabilized. And if the Charisian social restiveness Trenaire had just complained of melded with the Siddermarkian version of the same thing, the Church might find herself facing the greatest threat to her primacy of her entire history.
"Your Grace," he said, "I understand. These are grave matters, not really suited to open transmission over the semaphore, even if weather permitted it. However, I'll immediately draft new instructions to Bishop Executor Gerald and dispatch them overland by courier. I'll make him aware of your concerns and charge him to be particularly vigilant. And as soon as Sing Wu's passage clears in the spring, I'll personally journey to Telesburg."
"Good, Eric. That's good," Trenaire said, and smiled as he reached for his chocolate cup once again. 2. Telesburg, Kingdom of Charis.
"Hold!"
Merlin stepped back instantly, lowering his wooden training sword, and cocked his head inquiringly.
"Yes, Your Highness? Was there a problem?"
Crown Prince Caleb took his left hand from his own hilt, reached up, and dragged off his fencing mask. His face was streaked with sweat, and he was breathing more than a little hard as he glowered at Lieutenant Athrawes.
"You," he puffed, "don't sweat enough."
Merlin quirked an eyebrow politely. It was quite visible, since, unlike the prince, he wore neither a mask nor training armor.
"Sweat," Caleb told him severely, "is good for you. It opens the pores. Helps get rid of poisons."
"I appreciate your concern, Your Highness." Merlin inclined his head in a small bow. "But some of us take sufficient care with what we eat that we don't find it necessary to sweat out poisons."
"Oh, yes," Caleb snorted. "I've noticed what a picky eater you are." He shook his head. "You do your share at the table, Merlin."
"One tries, Your Highness. One tries." Caleb chuckled, and Merlin smiled. Although the prince's observation wasn't entirely humorous as far as Merlin was concerned. The fact that a pica was designed to allow its user to savor the taste of food and drink did, in fact, let him hold his own at meals. Unfortunately, a pica's waste disposal arrangements would have been more than enough to raise Safeholdian eyebrows, since he didn't have any digestive processes in the usual sense of the word. While the mechanics were essentially identical, what was left after his nannies had scavenged whatever they needed meant Merlin had to be careful to empty any chamber pots himself. It was perhaps fortunate that Safehold had developed indoor plumbing, at least in royal palaces. Then there was another minor technical difficulty which Caleb's humorous comment about sweating had put a finger squarely upon. Picas could sweat, but it wasn't exactly an ability of which most of their users had ever availed themselves, for fairly obvious reasons. Which meant producing that sweat in appropriate quantity and locations had required some finicky adjustments to Merlin's internal programming. And, as Caleb had noted, he still sweated extraordinarily lightly for a flesh-and-blood human being. Fortunately, the fact of his supposed sejinhood and the physical and mental disciplines which attached to it gave him a degree of cover, even at times like this. "Actually, Your Highness," he said, "I can't escape the feeling that you're criticizing my sweat level to distract attention from your own." "Oh, a low blow, Merlin," Caleb laughed and shook his head. "A low blow indeed." "With all due respect, Your Highness," Arnald Falcon observed from where he stood to one side of the training ground, "Merlin has a point. You do seem just a bit, damper than he does." "Because I'm not a Seijin, which he obviously is," Caleb pointed out. "I don't see you being willing to stand out here and let him humiliate you, Arnald." "Because I'm quite satisfied with the sword techniques I already know, Your Highness," Falcon replied cheerfully, and this time all three of them chuckled. "Well, it really is just a little humiliating," Caleb said, looking Merlin up and down. Unlike the prince's protective gear, Merlin had stripped to the waist while he instructed Caleb in the art of kendo. He felt just a little bit guilty about that. Caleb needed every bit of protection against Merlin's occasionally punishing touches that he could get, whereas the prince had yet to get a single stroke through Merlin's guard, unless Merlin chose to let him do so. Which wasn't really all that surprising, even though he strongly suspected that Caleb's natural aptitude considerably outclassed that of the flesh-and-blood Nimmu Alban. The Crown Prince, however, wasn't up against Nimmu. He was up against Merlin Athrawes, whose nervous impulses moved 100 times faster than his own. Merlin's reaction speed was quite literally inhuman, and he took full advantage of it while training Caleb. It wasn't simply to embarrass the prince either, as Caleb understood perfectly. Caleb had expressed an interest in Merlin's fighting style almost the first day after Merlin had been officially assigned as his bodyguard, and Merlin wasn't at all averse to teaching the young man a technique no one else on the entire planet could possibly be familiar with. Having agreed to teach him, though, and having produced a spare katana for the prince from his baggage, this one made out of regular steel, Merlin had deliberately used a pika's reactions and strength to put Caleb up against someone faster and stronger than any possible human opponent. The prince was a highly competitive youngster. He took his complete inability to pierce Merlin's guard as a challenge, not as a discouragement, and training against someone with Merlin's abilities ought to make taking on any mortal opponent seem like a casual stroll through the park. "Besides," Merlin thought with a mental smile, "I'm a Seijin. I'm supposed to be better than he is." Just a trace of his inner smile touched his lips as he recalled Pei Kaoyung teaching Nimmu Alban the same moves, the same techniques. "When you can snatch the pebble out of my hand, grasshopper," Kaoyung had said like some ritualistic phrase at the beginning of each bout, then proceeded to whack the holy living daylights out of her. Merlin still didn't know where he'd gotten the quotation from. He'd promised to tell Nimue the first time she outpointed him in a formal competition, and that day had never come. His smile faded, and he shook his head, looking at Caleb, remembering Cao Yung and Nimue. "If you'd been doing this as long as I have, Grasshopper," he said, "you'd be just as good at it as I am." "Grasshopper?" Caleb repeated, raising both eyebrows. There was a Safeholdian insect analog called a grasshopper, although this one was carnivorous and about 9 inches long. "Where did that come from?" "Ah," Merlin told him, "when you score 3 unanswered touches in a row, I'll tell you, Your Highness." "Oh, you will you?" Caleb glowered at him, and Falcon laughed. "You aren't helping here, Arnald," Caleb told him, and Falcon shrugged. "I think it's a perfectly reasonable stipulation, Your Highness. Think of it as a motivator." "Instead of an insurmountable challenge, you mean?" "Oh, I'd never call it that, Your Highness." Merlin's smile returned as he watched them. In experiential terms, he wasn't actually all that much older than Falcon. Nimue Alban had been only 27 standard years old when the Federation mounted Operation Ark, after all. Yet, as he looked at them, he felt far, far older. Perhaps some of the centuries which had trickled past while Nimue's Pika slept had left some sort of subliminal impress on his Mollycirk brain? "You'd better not call it that," Caleb told Falcon ominously, then scrubbed the back of one training gauntlet across his sweaty forehead. "If you don't mind, Merlin," he said, "I'm thinking I'd just as soon call it a day. In fact, I'm thinking that since Arnald here is so full of himself this afternoon, we might just try a little game of rugby." "Are you sure you want to go there, Your Highness?" Falcon asked, and Caleb smiled nastily. "Oh, I'm quite sure, Arnald, especially since I pick Merlin for the first member of my team." Falcon looked suddenly much more thoughtful, and Caleb chuckled. "Does Merlin know the rules?" the Marine inquired. "Rules? In rugby?" "Well, there is that," Falcon acknowledged, then shrugged. "Very well, Your Highness. Challenge accepted." Carizian rugby, it turned out, wasn't quite the game Merlin had expected. Nimue Alban had never actually played rugby, which had remained a thug's game played by gentlemen, in her father's estimation. She had, however, seen it played, and Merlin had felt reasonably confident of holding his own. But Carizian rugby was a water sport. Merlin had no idea who'd invented it, or retained the name of the old Earth game for it, but he could see certain similarities to the only rugby matches Nimue had ever seen. The object was to get the ball, actually the somewhat asymmetrical inflated bladder of a sea cow, a 10-foot-long, roughly walrus-like aquatic mammal, into the other team's net while playing shoulder-deep in the sea. Apparently, any tactic, short of actually drowning one of your opponents, was acceptable, as long as your intended victim had possession of the ball. Merlin was certain there had to be at least some rules, although it quickly became apparent there couldn't be very many. And strategy appeared to consist of swarming whoever had the ball and holding him under until he agreed to give it up. Normally that wouldn't have posed any difficulty for Merlin. After all, he had 10 times the strength of any of his opponents, his reaction speed was faster, and he had no particular need to breathe. Unfortunately, there were still a few minor technical problems. First, it seemed the Carizian custom when swimming, at least as long as only one sex was present, was to swim nude. Second, Carizian rugby was most definitely a contact sport. Third, Pikas were designed to be fully functional. Fourth, Nimue Alban had been a woman. Merlin had already observed that simply switching genders hadn't made women magically sexually attractive to him. He hadn't quite followed through to the corollary of that discovery, however, but when he abruptly found himself in the middle of a wet, splashing, slithery swirl of 17 other naked male bodies, all of them extraordinarily physically fit young male bodies, he discovered that, Pika or no, he was, indeed, fully functional. Nimmu had never really considered just how embarrassing her male friends and acquaintances must have found certain physiological responses to arousal, especially on social occasions. Merlin supposed the present occasion might be considered a social one, however, and he found that response extremely embarrassing. The fact that he'd never experienced it before only added to the interesting nature of the phenomenon. It also meant he spent the entire game very carefully staying in water which was at least chest deep, and that he was the last person out of the water, and that he deployed his towel very carefully when he finally did emerge.
"They don't play rugby where you come from?" Caleb asked him, vigorously toweling his hair,
and Merlin, whose towel was knotted around his waist, not drying his hair, shook his head. "The water's just a bit colder up in the Mountains of Light," he pointed out. It was a non sequitur, although there was no way for Caleb to know that, and he smiled. "We did play a game we called rugby when I was a child. It wasn't like this one, though. It was played on land."
"Ah, that explains it," Caleb chuckled.
"I was afraid there for a few minutes that Arnald's team might actually win. But you seem to get the hang of it after all." "Oh, I certainly did, Your Highness," Merlin said.
"Good, because next time I want to really pin his ears back."
"I'll certainly try," Merlin promised.
3. Vicar Robert Ducairne's suite, the Temple of God.
"I told you it wouldn't do any good,"
Zaspar Clinton said grumpily. The Grand Inquisitor was a portly man, with a head of carefully brushed silver hair and the substantial jowls of a man well accustomed to good food and drink. There were a few gravy spots on his orange cassock as he sat back from the table in Robert Ducairne's dining room at last and reached for his wine glass once more.
"Oh, come now, Zaspar," Ducairne said chidingly.
He was taller than Clinton, and rather more aesthetic in appearance.
"What exactly do you expect Dinis to do? The man's got a broken leg and a broken shoulder, for God's sake. He's scarcely going to go out, hop on a horse or a dragon, and go ploughing off through the winter."
"If he'd been doing his job properly before he broke his leg,"
Elaine Maguire said harshly,
"we wouldn't have this problem now, would we?"
"If we actually have a problem at all, of course,"
Ducairne replied in a rather more pointed tone.
Now, Robert," Zomson Trenaire said, "Elaine and Jasper may be a bit overly inclined to dwell on the negative, but I think you have to admit that you have a vested interest in overemphasizing the positive."
"If you mean I'm aware of the contributions Caris makes to the Treasury each year, you're quite correct,"
Ducairne conceded unapologetically.
"For that matter, I think all of us are also aware that it's substantially cheaper for our bailiffs and stewards to buy Carisian goods than it is to buy from the Republic or the Empire."
Clinton's snort sounded remarkably porcine, but both Maguire and Trenaire nodded, if only grudgingly in Maguire's case. Any one of the men seated around that table in the comfort of the temple's warmth was more powerful, even in purely secular terms, than the vast majority of Safehold's dukes and grand dukes. Most of them controlled vast church estates in other lands and kingdoms as well, but all of them were the masters of wealthy, powerful fiefdoms in the temple lands themselves. In addition to their membership on the Council of Vicars, all of them also held seats on the ruling council of the Knights of the Temple Lands, the official governing body of the Temple Lands. And whether they wanted to admit it or not, All of them were aware that the Carisian manufactories and the Carisian merchant marine could provide the goods and luxuries they required at a much lower price than anyone else. Not to mention the fact that Caris paid at least 3 or 4 times as much per capita in tithes every year than any other Safeholdian kingdom. "None of us wants to kill the wyvern that fetches the golden rabbit, Robert," Trinair said. "But the truth is, and you know it as well as I do, that the time is coming when Caris is going to have to be seen to. It's getting too powerful, too successful, and it's too damned in love with its innovations." "Hear, hear," Clinton muttered, and drank deeply from his wine glass. Trinair grimaced, but neither he nor either of his two companions were fooled. Zaspar Clinton was a glutton by nature, and not just for food and drink, but he was also a dangerously intelligent man, and a very complex one. His was an odd fusion of ambition, laziness, cynicism, and a genuine fervor for the responsibilities of his high office. He could demonstrate furious energy one day and utter lethargy the next, but only a fool took him lightly. "Zamsin's right, Robert," Magwer said after a moment. "Harald and his flea-bite kingdom are useful. No one questions that. But they're also a danger, and one we can't allow to grow much greater." Ducairn grunted in sour agreement. Then he cocked his head with a nasty little smile. "There are those reports from Father Pater, Jaspar," he pointed out provocatively.
"Bugger Father Pater!" Clinton growled. "He and that whole Wilson bunch are all pains in the arse."
Trinair hastily picked up his own wine glass, using it to hide his sudden smile. Magwer was less tactful and let out a sharp crack of laughter. One of the reasons Father Pater Wilson had been packed off to Caris, as all of Clinton's allies were aware, was that his father had been Clinton's closest competitor for the post of Grand Inquisitor. It had been a very close-run contest, and, in the end, Clinton had won primarily because the Wilson reputation for reformatory zeal had made a slim majority of the council nervous.
"If Father Pater were doing his job properly, we wouldn't have to pussyfoot around this way," Clinton grumbled.
"Then call him home and replace him," Ducairn suggested sweetly.
"Ha! That'd be a wonderful idea, wouldn't it?"
Clinton half sneered.
"Can't you just see him and his daddy standing up in the council to complain that I was pressuring him to falsify his reports?"
Ducairn started to launch another jab, then stopped himself and shrugged. After all, Clinton was right. That was precisely what young Father Pater would do, and his father and the other members of his unfortunately powerful family would undoubtedly support him. Reputation for piety or no, most of them wouldn't care one way or the other about the grounds for the dispute, but they would never pass up the opportunity to whittle away at the Group of Four's power base in any way they could.
"You probably have a point, Jaspar," he conceded instead, after a moment. "On the other hand, we are stuck with his reports."
"You're right about that," Magwer agreed moodily. No one suggested undertaking a little judicious editing of the reports in question, although all of them knew it had been done in the past. But the same political considerations which put simply recalling young Wilson out of consideration would have applied to any liberties they might take with his written reports.
Besides, Ducairn thought, the sanctimonious little twerps almost certainly sent duplicate copies of his reports to his father.
"So I'm not going to be able to deal with the problem," Clinton pointed out. "Not any time soon, anyway."
"And without being called in by Jaspar, I can't either," Magwer added bitterly.
"As if we had the naval power to attack Caris ourselves in the first place," Ducairn thought.
"Direct action may not be our best course anyway," Trinair said.
All eyes turned to him, and the Chancellor shrugged.
We've already been encouraging Hector and Narmon. Perhaps it's time we began considering who else we might encourage.
Ducairne grunted unhappily at the thought. It wasn't as if the council hadn't used similar approaches in the past. Nor, as much as he would have preferred to, could he simply dismiss his colleagues' worries over Karis out of hand. As they said, it wasn't so much the direct threat Karis represented as it was the threat of Karis's example.
"Who did you have in mind?" Maguire asked Trenaire. "We know Hector's been working on Gorgia of Taro," Trenaire pointed out. "We could lend our weight to his efforts there. It might be wise to establish at least some preliminary contacts with Ranald of Dolar as well. And it may be time to at least alert Jerome Vincent in Chisholm."
"Isn't it a bit early for that sort of thinking, at least where Dolar and Chisholm are concerned?"
Ducairne asked, and Trenaire shrugged.
"It may be," he conceded. "On the other hand, arranging this sort of thing takes time. The distance between the temple and Karis, or between the temple and Coruscant for that matter, works against us. If we do decide we need to throw Dolar's and Chisholm's weight into the scales, it would be wise, I think, to have done the preliminary spade work well ahead of time."
"Who would you use?"
Clinton inquired, emerging from his wine glass just long enough to ask the question.
"Joshua MacGregor is already in place in Taro, and he and I discussed this eventuality before I sent him. In fact, I gave him fairly detailed contingency directives. As soon as we get a break in the weather long enough for us to get semaphore messages out, I can instruct him to dust off those directives and get to work on Gorgia. In Chisholm's case, Vincent is actually making his pastoral visit right now, and he had plenty of experience in the diplomatic service as an upper priest. He'd understand exactly what our thinking is, and having him broach the subject personally with Charlian would certainly carry additional weight, if we decided to do that. Even if we only warned him about it, he could give personal contingency instructions to his bishop executor in case we decide we need to bring Chisholm in later. As for Dolar, I'm thinking about sending young Harris to Gorath."
"Albert Harris?"
Maguire leaned back in his chair with a frown. "Isn't he perhaps a bit too young for something like this?"
"I think he's ready," Trenaire disagreed. "And he's already demonstrated a remarkable sensitivity to this aspect of diplomacy. Besides, using someone as young as he is gives us certain alternatives if we decide we don't want to proceed. For one thing, he's young and inexperienced enough that we could put down any preliminary exploration of the possibilities to over-enthusiasm on his part, and the season gives us an excellent excuse to send him instead of someone more senior. After all, he's got the youth to undertake a trip that long through this kind of winter."
Heads nodded, Ducairne's among them. A young, inexperienced diplomat who'd misunderstood his instructions, or possibly simply exceeded them in a burst of youthful exuberance, represented a ready-made way out if Trenaire should need to disavow any suggestions to Ranald IV. Robert Ducairne understood that perfectly, which wasn't the same thing as saying that he thought it was a good idea. Unfortunately, his hesitance to unleash the church's full wrath on Karis put him in a clear minority of one, and the group of four could not afford to show its many enemies on the Council of Vicars any appearance of internal dissension.
"I understand your concerns," he said after several seconds, addressing all three of the others. "And, to be honest, I suppose I do share them myself.
But Karis really is the wyvern that catches golden rabbits. If we destroy its maritime power, we destroy the basis for its wealth, and all the advantages that wealth offers to us, as well as to Harald and his house."
"So," Maguire shrugged, "Hector and Narmon seem eager enough to take Harald's place." "If they could do that,"
Ducairne thought acidly, then they'd already be serious competitors of his, wouldn't they? There's more to Corus's success than simply owning a few ships. But that wasn't something anyone was prepared to say out loud around this table, was it? Then I'll see to setting up the preliminary briefing for Father Albert and composing the proper messages to Father Joshua and Archbishop Jerome tomorrow morning, Trenaire said, picking up his own wine glass and extending it to Ducairne. But for now, could I trouble you for a little more of that really excellent wine, Robert? 4. Marine Training Area, Helen Island. Brian Lock Island, Earl of Lock Island, climbed down from the saddle with a sense of profound gratitude which was only slightly flawed by the knowledge that he would have to climb back up into it for the return journey. The High Admiral was reasonably fit for a man of his years, but he spent too much time on shipboard. There wasn't room aboard a galley for anyone, and especially for an officer of his rank, to get the sort of exercise which kept a man from feeling short-winded. Worse, he thought as he massaged his aching buttocks with a grimace, sea officers spent very little time riding horses. Even those who'd been thoroughly schooled in horsemanship as youngsters, as he himself had been, got precious little opportunity to maintain the necessary skills.
"Or the tough asses to avoid saddle sores," he reflected wryly.
He finished the massage and took a couple of trial steps. Everything seemed to be working more or less the way it ought to be, and he turned to his aide.
"It appears I'm going to survive after all, Henry."
"Of course you are, my lord,"
Lieutenant Henry Tillier replied gravely, although amusement glinted in his eyes. Lock Island smiled back, even as he reminded himself not to take vengeance on Tillier for his youthful tolerance for silliness like horseback riding.
"I just hope this is all worth the exercise,"
the High Admiral grumbled.
"Oh, I believe you'll be suitably impressed, my lord," Tillier assured him, "if you'll come this way."
Lock Island followed in his aide's wake, stumping along the steep path with an air of resignation. Actually, little though he was prepared to admit it to anyone else, it was a pleasant enough walk, despite the steepness. They were over 1,000 feet above sea level, and the additional height, coupled with the breeze blowing in off Howell Bay, was a cool interlude in a typically warm Carisian spring. The path topped out on a high ridgeline, and a mountain valley stretched out before them. There was an observation tower at the western edge of the valley, where the mountains broke steeply downward towards the bay, so far below. From that vantage point, a lookout could see for the better part of 40 miles, and a lookout on the King's Harbor Citadel could look straight up the mountain and see any signals from the tower. Maintaining the observation post was a responsibility of the Royal Carisian Marines, and had been for years. Largely as a consequence, the Marines had gotten into the habit of using the valley and surrounding mountains as exercise areas. Unfortunately, Lock Island acknowledged to himself, they didn't use them for exercises as much as, perhaps, they really ought to. The Kingdom of Corus had no standing army. The Carisian nobility had its personal retainers, whom the crown could summon to the national colors in an emergency, but even the most powerful of them had no more than 100 or so men under his direct personal command nowadays, and an army of feudal levies had become increasingly anachronistic, and of increasingly dubious value, over the last century or so anyway. There was a national militia, of course, but it was undermanned and not particularly well drilled. Confronted by something like a company of Sidermark pikemen or Desnary cavalry, a Carisian militia unit wouldn't have been even a bad joke. What the kingdom did have, however, were the Royal Carisian Marines. There were never as many of them as Lock Island would have liked, but they were tough, professional, well-trained, and confident. Indeed, if anything, they were overconfident. Like the Navy, the Marines were accustomed to winning, even against steep odds, and there was no seagoing infantry force in the world which could match them. Overall, that had served Corus well over the years. The navy was the kingdom's true defense. Nothing could threaten its people and its territory without first getting past the fleet, after all. But it would have been a serious mistake to think of the Marines as any sort of field army. They seldom, if ever, deployed in greater than battalion strength. They had no experience at all in large-scale land combat, and they were equipped and trained for the close-quarters fighting aboard ship, not for open field maneuvers. Yet that, too, was going to have to change. If not tomorrow or the next day, it was still going to have to change soon enough, and that was what brought Lock Island to this cool valley this morning.
"Well, there you are, Brian," a youthful voice called, and the High Admiral turned to find Crown Prince Caleb walking towards him.
Merlin Athrawis and Arnald Falcon followed at the prince's heels, along with a marine major Lock Island had never seen before, and the Earl grimaced.
"I still don't see why we couldn't have done this in a civilized setting like the deck of a ship," he complained to his crown prince. "After all, we're already testing the first of Alfred's new guns out at sea, so maintaining secrecy wouldn't have been a problem. And, meaning no disrespect, Your Highness, but I'd much rather be standing on my own quarter-deck than here, with my ass burning and that never-to-be-sufficiently-damned horse waiting to take me back down the mountain later."
"Just getting you up here for a little exercise would be worthwhile all by itself," Caleb said with a grin as he reached Lock Island and held out his right hand. The two of them clasped arms, and the Crown Prince chuckled.
"You really ought to take some time to spend a few hours in the saddle here and there. Maybe even join me on a slash lizard hunt or two. You're getting soft, Brian."
"And when you're my age, so will you," Lock Island retorted.
"Nonsense," Caleb disagreed, with the cheerfully arrogant confidence of youth. Then his expression sobered.
"Actually, there are some perfectly valid reasons for bringing you up here to show you this particular new toy of Merlin's, Brian. For one thing, we've got plenty of room, and don't have to worry about targets that sink before we can examine them. For another thing, you can't really appreciate what Merlin's about to show you if you're on a moving deck. And for another, this is where Major Clarek is going to be working out the best way to use it."
The Crown Prince nodded to the Marine Major who had followed him and his two bodyguards. The Major came quickly to attention and saluted, touching his left shoulder with his right fist. Lock Island studied him for a moment, then returned the salute. Major Kint Clarek was on the young side for an officer of his rank, but he looked both tough and intelligent. And perhaps even more important than that, Lock Island knew, he, like every single man of his command, had been selected for his total loyalty and discretion as well.
"Well, I'm here now anyway, Your Highness," the High Admiral said, turning back to the Crown Prince.
"Yes, you are, and so cheerful about it, too," Caleb observed with another grin. "And since you are, I suppose we might as well get started."
He turned and began walking towards the parade ground in front of the modest block of barracks built against the valley's steep northern wall. A platoon of Marines waited there under the supervision of a lieutenant and his grizzled sergeant, and all of them snapped to attention and saluted as Caleb and Lock Island approached. They looked like any other platoon of Marines Lock Island had ever seen, with one exception. They were smartly turned out in their blue tunics and trousers and broad-brimmed black hats, and they had the typical, almost arrogant confidence of men who knew they were elite troops. They were armed with the standard cutlass and boarding axe of the Carisian Marines, but they were also armed with something else, and that was the exception.
"Here, Brian."
Caleb reached out, and a corporal handed him his weapon.
"Take a look," the Crown Prince invited, handing the same weapon across to the High Admiral.
Lock Island took it a bit gingerly. He'd seen matchlock muskets in plenty, of course. They were used on shipboard in the preliminary stages of a boarding action, although they were utterly useless once an opponent with a cutlass or boarding axe got within a few yards. But while it was obvious the weapon in his hands was at least related to a matchlock, it was like no other musket Lock Island had ever seen. For one thing, it was lighter, despite its length, and the stock and forestock were much sleeker. In fact, The entire weapon had a smooth, slim, wicked look to it, and as he hefted it in his hands, he realized it was enough lighter that it probably wouldn't need the crutch-like brace from which the musketeers normally fired their weapons. All of those aspects, however, were secondary to the difference between a matchlock and this weapon's firing mechanism. Instead of the long, serpentine arm and lever designed to hold the length of a smoldering, slow match which was lowered into a matchlock's priming pan when it was fired, it had a much smaller, odd-looking lock. An S-shaped striker held a lump of shaped flint clamped between its jaws, and Lock Island shook his head as he contemplated the elegant simplicity of the concept which had never occurred to anyone else. He turned the musket over, noting the ramrod, made of steel, not the usual wood, in its carrying well in the forestock. Then he frowned as he found the odd lug protruding from the right side of the barrel behind the muzzle, just in front of the leading edge of the forestock and offset far enough to clear the end of the ramrod easily. He had no idea what that was for, but he felt confident he was about to find out, and he handed the weapon back to Caleb.
"It looks impressive, Your Highness,"
he admitted. "Yes, it does," Caleb agreed, returning the musket to its owner. "And it's even more impressive in action. Major?"
"Of course, Your Highness,"
Clerake replied, and nodded to the lieutenant.
"Firing positions, Lieutenant Lane, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Lieutenant Lane acknowledged, and nodded in turn to his sergeant. That gray-bearded worthy had been waiting patiently, and only the merest hint of a curled upper lip and an exposed canine were sufficient to send the men of Lieutenant Lane's platoon double-timing across the parade ground to the shooting range along its eastern side. Caleb and the other senior officers followed at a more leisurely pace. By the time they got there, Lieutenant Lane and his sergeant had the 40-man platoon arranged in 2 20-man lines. The Marines stood spaced about a yard apart, staggered so that the men in the second rank lined up with the spaces in the first rank, facing downrange towards a line of 30 or so human-sized mannequins at least 150 yards away. The mannequins were obviously made of straw, but each of them wore a standard Marine-issue cuirass and helmet.
"What's the best range for aimed fire you've ever seen out of a matchlock, Brian?" Caleb asked, and the High Admiral snorted.
"You mean the longest range where I've ever actually seen them hit something, or the longest range at which I've seen them wasting powder trying to hit something?"
"Let's stick with actually hitting something," Caleb said dryly. "In fact, let's be a little more specific. What's the longest range at which you've ever seen someone with a matchlock actually hit a particular man-sized target?"
"Well,"
Lock Island said thoughtfully, his expression much more serious,
"that's not really such an easy question. For one thing, I've mostly seen them used at sea. The range is usually fairly low by the time they come into action, and the fact that all the ships involved are moving doesn't help much. Probably the longest range I've ever actually seen a hit scored would be at about, 40 yards. I understand volley fire can score hits out to 100, even 150 yards in a land engagement, on the other hand. I don't imagine the percentage of hits is very high even there, though, and as I understand it, no one's even trying to aim at a specific target at that range. They're simply blazing away in the enemy's general direction."
"That's about right," Caleb agreed. "Generally speaking, effective musket range is about 80 yards, which is exactly half the range from Lieutenant Lane's front line to the targets down there."
The Crown Prince let the High Admiral think about that for a moment, then nodded to Clerake.
"Proceed, Major," he said, and glanced back at Lock Island.
"You might want to put your fingers in your ears," he suggested. Lock Island only looked at him for a moment, suspecting a joke, but Caleb was already putting his own fingers into his ears, and the High Admiral decided to follow suit as Clerake stepped up beside the nearer end of the first of Lieutenant Lane's 2 lines.
"Load!"
he commanded. Each Marine grounded the butt of his musket, holding it just behind the muzzle with his left hand, while his right unbuttoned the cover of the hard leather case on his right hip. He reached into the case and extracted a rolled-up twist of paper, raised it to his mouth, and bit off the end. He tipped the truncated paper up, spilling the granulated black powder it held down the muzzle of his weapon, then spat the bullet he'd bitten off after the powder. The empty cartridge paper was stuffed into the muzzle, the ramrod came out of its well, and shoved the wadded paper, bullet, and powder charge home with a single strong stroke. Then the rod went back into its place, and the Marine raised his musket, turned it up on its side so that the flintlock was down, and struck it sharply once. Then the musket came back upright, held in a port arms position. The entire evolution couldn't have taken more than 15 seconds, Lock Island thought, which was far, far faster than he'd ever seen a matchlock loaded, yet their smooth drill hadn't seemed especially hurried.
"Front rank, take aim!"
Clarate commanded, and the front rank's muskets rose. The brass butt plates pressed into their shoulders, and their right hands cocked the flintlock strikers, which automatically raised the priming pan lids, before setting into place with the index finger curved about the ridiculously tiny trigger.
"Fire!"
Clarake barked, and 20 muskets exploded as one. Lock Island's ears cringed, despite the fingers he'd thrust into them, and a choking cloud of powder smoke billowed up.
"First rank, reload!"
he heard through the ringing in his ears.
"Second rank, present!"
The first rank stepped back a pace, right hands already reaching for their cartridge boxes once again. The second rank stepped forward a pace at the same moment, so that the two lines essentially exchanged positions.
"Second rank, take aim!"
the major snapped, and the new first rank's muskets rose to their shoulders and cocked. Clarake waited for perhaps another 5 seconds, then,
"Fire!"
he ordered, and a fresh 20-musket volley cracked out.
"Second rank, reload! First rank, present!"
Lock Island could hardly believe it. The first rank had actually reloaded. Now they stepped back into their original positions, while the second rank retired into their initial positions. Again, the brief pause, until Lock Island realized the second rank's Marines were halfway through their own reloading cycle, and then the first rank's muskets fired. The process repeated a total of 3 times, with a fresh blast of musketry smashing downrange every 10 seconds. In less than 1 minute, the 40 men of Lieutenant Lane's platoon fired 120 rounds. The same number of matchlock musketeers would have gotten off a single shot apiece in that same interval, and Lock Island suspected that Lane's men could have reloaded even more rapidly.
"Cease fire!"
Clarake shouted, his voice sounding tinny and distorted in the wake of the concentrated musket fire.
"Safe your weapons,"
the major added at a more conversational level, and the platoon grounded its musket butts smartly. Clarake looked at them for a moment, then turned to Caleb and Lock Island.
"Would you care to inspect the targets, Your Highness, High Admiral?"
he asked.
"Brian?"
Caleb invited, and Lock Island gave himself a shake.
"I certainly would, Your Highness,"
he said, and he, Caleb, Merlin, Major Clarake, and Lieutenant Falcon hiked across to the mannequins.
"Sweet Langhorn!"
Lock Island murmured as he got close enough to the targets to see what the half-inch musket balls had done to them. He'd seen breastplates pierced by muskets at relatively short ranges, but he'd seen at least as many dished in and splashed with lead where they'd turned balls instead, especially at longer ranges. These breastplates hadn't done that, and the High Admiral's eyes widened as he saw the holes punched clear through them. That was impressive enough, but almost equally impressive, each of those breastplates had been hit at least 3 times. That was a minimum of 90 hits out of 120 shots fired, and no matchlock musketeers in the world could have matched that percentage of hits at such a range. He reached out, running the tip of one finger around the rim of a bullet hole, then turned to look not at Caleb, but at Merlin.
"How?"
he asked simply. "The rate of fire's fairly self-explanatory, I think, my lord," Merlin replied gravely. One thing which may not have been too obvious is that the flintlock touch hole is cone-shaped. The opening's wider on the inside, so it acts as a funnel. Instead of having to prime the pan in a separate operation, all they have to do is give the musket a sharp whack to shake powder from the main charge into the pan. That, the cartridges, and the steel ramrods mean they can simply reload faster, much faster, than anyone's ever been able to before. As far as the accuracy is concerned, he continued, indicating the multiple holes in each breastplate, these aren't just muskets, my lord. They're also rifles. Lock Island's eyebrows rose. The principle of spinning a projectile to stabilize it in flight had been known to archers and crossbowmen for centuries. It hadn't taken all that long for someone to figure out that cutting rifling grooves into a musket barrel could impart the same stabilization to a musket ball. But no one had ever suggested using rifled muskets as serious weapons of war because they took so long to load. In order to force the bullet into the rifling, it was necessary to use an oversized ball and literally hammer it down the barrel, which reduced the musket's already arthritic rate of fire to complete battlefield uselessness.
"Rifles?" he repeated, and Caleb nodded.
"Look at this," he invited, and held out a musket ball. But no, it wasn't a ball at all, Lock Island realized as he accepted it. It was a slightly elongated cylinder, rounded at one end, but hollow at the other. When the powder charge explodes, Caleb explained, it spreads the hollow end of the bullet and forces it into the rifling. It also seals the bore, which traps more of the powder's power behind the ball. It may not be too obvious, but the barrels on these flintlocks are actually longer than most matchlocks. Coupled with the way the balls seal the bore, that extra length gives each shot more velocity and power. Lock Island looked up from the bullet and shook his head slowly.
"It's really that simple?"
"It's really that simple," Caleb confirmed.
"How far does it extend the effective range?" the High Admiral asked. "I remember watching Earl Pine Mountain on a hunt a few years ago. He had a rifled matchlock from Hachong, I think, and took down a prong lizard at almost 200 yards.
"Well," Caleb said, "let's go back to the firing line, shall we?" He led the way back to where Lieutenant Lane and his platoon stood waiting. Then he looked at Merlin.
"Would you care to do the honors?"
he asked with a wicked gleam in his eye.
"Of course, Your Highness," Merlin murmured, and turned to the same corporal whose musket Lock Island had examined earlier.
"If I may?"
he asked, holding out his hand, and the corporal handed the weapon over with a broad grin, followed by his cartridge box. Merlin accepted both of them and calmly loaded the rifle. He shook powder into the pan, then turned back to Caleb.
"May I assume you had a target in mind, Your Highness?" he asked mildly.
"As a matter of fact, I do," Caleb assured him with a grin even broader than the corporal's. "In fact, I think I may have found one that will challenge even you, Merlin."
Merlin merely raised an eyebrow, and Caleb turned and pointed downrange. Not at the mannequins which had served as the Marines' targets, but beyond them. Well beyond them, Lock Island realized, as he saw the additional mannequin standing all by itself at least 400 yards away from them.
"That does seem a rather long shot, Your Highness," Merlin observed.
"Oh, I'm certain you can do it," Caleb said encouragingly. Merlin gave him a moderately reproving look, then stepped slightly out in front of the front rank of Marines. He gazed downrange, sapphire eyes intent. None of the people watching him realized he was using a Pika's built-in laser ranging capability to determine the exact distance to his target. It worked out at 412 yards, and he nodded to himself. Unlike any of the flesh-and-blood humans about him, Merlin knew the average muscle velocity of the new rifles. No one on Safehold had yet gotten around to developing the chronograph, which someone on old Earth would have used to measure the muzzle velocity of a firearm, but Merlin didn't need one. Or, rather, he had one already built in. Now he cocked the lock and raised the rifle into firing position. A red crosshair superimposed itself on his vision, well above the mannequin. As his CPU calculated the bullet's trajectory and indicated the proper point of aim, and he captured the front sight in the open V of the simple rear sight and aligned both of them on the glowing icon only he could see. The crosshair steadied itself. In fact, it steadied with literally inhuman precision, for no flesh-and-blood human could have held that rifle so utterly, completely still. And then Merlin smoothly and steadily squeezed the trigger. The striker snapped forward, the pan flashed, and the rifle spewed out the usual cloud of powder smoke as it slammed thunderously back against his shoulder with the brutal recoil of any large-caliber black powder weapon. Then, 412 yards downrange, the mannequin's helmet leapt off its head and spun, flashing in the sunlight, before it thudded to the ground. "Oh, dear," Merlin murmured, turning to Caleb with a smile. "I'm afraid we're going to need another new helmet, Your Highness."
"I see why you wanted to keep all this out of sight, Your Highness,"
Lock Island conceded 2 hours later. He stood with the Crown Prince, Merlin, and Lieutenant Tillier, waiting while a couple of Marines fetched his and Tillier's horses for the return journey to King's Harbor. "It is something we'd like to keep under wraps," Caleb replied, "and Major Clarake and Lieutenant Lane have been doing some interesting things working out the best tactics. It's not just as simple as standing in place and blazing away, although that's probably going to be effective enough at first, given our range advantage and rate of fire. Eventually, though, both sides are going to have rifles, and when that happens, standing out in the open is going to be a good way to get lots and lots of people killed very quickly."
"I can well believe that,"
Lock Island said, with a shudder which wasn't at all feigned. "The fact that every rifleman becomes his own pikeman as soon as he fixes his bayonet is also going to have a major impact in any boarding action, my lord," Lieutenant Falcon pointed out diffidently, and Lock Island nodded. He understood the reason for the odd-shaped lugs on the rifle barrels now. The thing Merlin called a ring bayonet was essentially a knife with a 14-inch two-sided blade and an open ring formed into one end of its crossguard. The ring fitted down over the muzzle in front of the front sight, and a simple half-twist locked a cutout in the knife's hilt over the lug to hold it firmly in place. The weapon could still be loaded and fired, although the rate of fire slowed drastically, and, as Falcon had said, it literally turned each musket into a boarding pike, which meant it would no longer be necessary for Marine musketeers to drop their firearms once the melee began. "At the same time, Brian," Caleb said very seriously, "one reason I wanted you to see this is that we have a decision to make, and I want your views on it before we do. Specifically, do we really want to begin issuing rifles to all our Marines?"
"What?"
The High Admiral felt his eyebrows arch in surprise at the question.
"Why shouldn't we want to, Your Highness?"
he asked after a moment. "I can think of two main reasons," Caleb replied. "First, it takes much longer to make a rifle than it does to make a smoothbore musket. We can probably produce as many as 3 or even 5 smoothbores for each rifle. Master Hausman's going to move musket production to his new Delphac foundry as soon as he can. He ought to be able to begin producing them there sometime late next month, and putting it all under one roof will let him be sure all the interchangeable parts are really interchangeable." The prince made a face, and Merlin hid a smile. Over the past few months, Caleb had become aware of the disadvantages inherent in the absence of a truly uniform system of measurements. The notion of using interchangeable parts wasn't a totally new one, but if 2 different manufactories' inches weren't actually identical, the parts one of them produced wouldn't work in the muskets the other one produced. Which was why Hausman was making certain that all of his facilities used the same sized units of measurement used at King's Harbor. Once he has his rifle shop fully set up there, which is going to take a month or so longer, he'll have two or three times as many rifling benches as he has now, Caleb continued. The overall production rate will go up, and the production ratio will shift a bit in the rifle's favor, but rifling barrels takes time and represents an entire additional stage in the process, which means we'll always be able to produce smoothbores more rapidly than rifles. And while the range advantage of a rifle is really nice to have, we've also got to think in terms of having enough of them to do the job. Second, once we begin issuing them, and once they're used in action, everyone's going to want the same sorts of weapons for their infantry. And, let's face it, it's not going to be that difficult to duplicate them. We're not introducing any new principles or processes in the weapon itself, aside from the flintlock, which isn't an especially complicated proposition.
So you're thinking about holding the new bullets in reserve,
Lock Island said slowly, and Caleb nodded.
We'll be able to rifle the barrels of existing muskets a lot faster than we could build them as rifles from scratch, he pointed out.
If we hold the new bullets in reserve, as you put it, we can take advantage of the superior rate of fire and the new bayonets immediately, and still have a decisive advantage up our sleeves once other people begin duplicating flintlock muskets. And all the smoothbores we've built in the meantime will be available for rifling when the time comes.
But even that's going to be a fairly fleeting advantage, Your Highness,
Lock Island pointed out. Oh, I know that, Caleb nodded again. I'm not saying I'm wedded to the concept of delaying the introduction of the rifles. I'm simply saying that I think it's something we need to consider. Either way, Major Claret needs to go ahead developing tactics for both the smoothbores and the rifles, of course.
You're certainly correct about that, Your Highness,
Lock Island said a bit grimly. Caleb cocked his head, and the High Admiral snorted.
Your Highness, dealing with Narmon and probably Hector isn't going to be the end of this, you know. In fact, it's only going to be the beginning. So whether we introduce the rifles immediately or not, we're going to need them soon. Probably very soon.
5. Royal Palace, Erastur. Prince Narmon sat back in his chair, resting his forearms on the carved wooden armrests, and watched without expression as an extraordinarily ordinary-looking man followed Baron Shandir and Travis Olson, the Earl of Pine Hollow, into the meeting chamber of his Privy Council. The bodyguards outside the meeting chamber door braced to attention as Narmon's first counselor and spymaster walked past them. The two guardsmen standing behind Narmon's chair did not.
So, the prince said as the door closed behind the new arrivals, I understand you have some fresh report for me.
His tone wasn't encouraging, not that any of them were surprised.
We do, my prince, Pine Hollow said, speaking to his cousin rather more formally than was his wont. And no, he continued in a drier tone, it's not news you're really going to want to hear.
Something almost like a smile flickered at the corner of Narmon's mouth, and Shandir allowed himself a feeling of cautious relief. The prince's mood had been difficult ever since the first intimations of the disaster Shandir's organization in Karras had suffered. Pine Hollow understood that, and the Baron was grateful to the First Counselor for his willingness to help divert the brunt of Narmon's displeasure from Shandir's own shoulders. The fact that Travis Olson was probably the one man on Safehold whom Narmon unreservedly trusted didn't hurt a thing, either.
Well, that certainly has the virtue of frankness, the prince said after a moment. Then the almost smile, if that's what it had been, vanished, and he switched his gaze to Shandir.
You may as well go ahead and tell me, he half-growled.
Yes, my prince.
Shandir bowed and indicated the man who'd accompanied him in Pine Hollow.
My prince, this is Maris Willems.
Narmon's eyes narrowed slightly, and the Baron nodded.
Yes, my prince. Master Willems has finally managed to reach home.
So I see. Narmin regarded Willems thoughtfully as the man went to one knee and bent his head. The prince let him kneel there for several seconds, then waved one hand.
"Rise, Master Willems," he said, and waited until Willems had obeyed the command. Then he cocked his head to one side and pursed his lips.
"I'm relieved to see you," he continued, "if not exactly delighted by the fact that you're here. I trust you can give us some first-hand information as to exactly what went wrong."
"I'll do my best, Your Highness," Willems replied respectfully. "All the same, sire, please remember that I've been trying to find my way home without being taken by Wave Thunder's agents for over 2 months. The information I have is certainly out of date by now."
"That's understood," Narmin said brusquely. "Just tell us what you do know."
"Well, Your Highness, as I've already reported to Baron Shandir, I'm not at all sure what originally caused them to suspect the Duke. When Greyharbor came to the townhouse, he and the Duke met privately in the library, and I was unable to overhear any of their discussion. I do know the Duke had ordered 15 of his guardsmen to stand ready for his summons outside the library, though, because I personally took his note to his guard captain. After he and Greyharbor had been alone in the library, except for Greyharbor's personal guardsman, for perhaps 15 minutes, I heard the bell ring and his men enter the library."
Willems paused for a moment, then shook his head with the expression of a man who wasn't certain his next few words were going to be believed.
"Your Highness, I knew the quality of the guardsmen the Duke had summoned, and I personally ushered Earl Greyharbor into the library. After handing the Duke's note to Captain Janssen, I took it upon myself to deliver brandy to the library as well, in order to pick up whatever information I could. At that time, the Duke, the Earl, and the Earl's guardsmen were the only ones in the room, and although I wasn't supposed to know it, I also knew that the Earl's guardsman had been placed in his service years earlier by the Duke himself. Knowing all of that, I felt confident the Duke's men would easily take Greyharbor into custody, if that was what he intended. What might have happened then was more than I could begin to predict, although I suspect the Duke was prepared to act upon the contingency plans for a coup he'd made long ago. I can't believe he might have had anything else in mind after ordering his men to seize the kingdom's first counselor, at any rate. But what did happen was that I heard the sound of fighting from inside the library. Lots of fighting, Your Highness. It couldn't have lasted more than a very few minutes, but there shouldn't have been any, not with Greyharbor alone against what amounted to 16 of the Duke's men. With the lateness of the hour, there'd been very few other servants in that wing of the house when Greyharbor arrived. Those who had been present had been sent away by Captain Janssen, presumably on the Duke's orders, to avoid any unfortunate witnesses. So, what with the noise of the storm and all, I doubted anyone else had heard the fighting. I didn't know what was happening myself, but from the sound of things, they weren't going the way the Duke had planned. So I positioned myself behind a door to one of the servants' passages from which I could watch the library door. If the Duke's men had prevailed, I was certain he'd come out of the library soon. He didn't. Instead, the library door opened, and a man I'd never seen before stepped out of it.
"A man you'd never seen before?"
Narmin repeated, leaning forward in his chair with a frown of confusion.
"Exactly, Your Highness," Willems nodded as if for emphasis. "I knew exactly who was in the library, or I'd thought I did, at least. I suppose it's possible someone else could have arrived while I was taking the Duke's note to Captain Janssen, but he would have had to somehow enter the townhouse and find his way to the library without any of the other servants seeing him. Besides, I should have seen him when I served the brandy, and I didn't. Yet there he was."
"What sort of man?"
Narmon asked intently. Baron Shandir was cautiously pleased by the prince's expression. It was certainly better than the sour, half-accusatory glowers which had been coming the spymaster's way of late.
"Apparently an officer of the Royal Guard, Your Highness."
"The Royal Guard?"
"Yes, Your Highness. He wore the guard's livery with lieutenant's insignia."
"You say he came out of the library?"
Narmon asked, and Willems nodded.
"What did he do then?"
"He called for a servant, Your Highness, so I opened the door and went to him."
Narmon's eyes widened ever so slightly, and he sat back once more.
"You went to him?"
he repeated, an edge of respect in his voice, and Willems shrugged.
"I was a servant, Your Highness, and it was a servant he was calling for. It seemed unlikely he intended to arrest or attack whoever responded, and it was my best, possibly my only, opportunity to find out what had happened."
"And what had happened?"
Narmon pressed.
"At the time, Your Highness, I didn't really know. The stranger had pulled the library door mostly closed behind him, and I could see little. What I did see, however, was a great deal of blood, and at least two bodies, both in the Duke's colours. As nearly as I could tell, every one of the Duke's men had been killed."
"All of them?"
"That was my impression then, Your Highness, and the rumours I managed to collect on my way north all agree that they were."
Narmon looked at Shandir and his cousin for a moment, then back at Willems.
"What happened then?"
"The guardsman ordered me to summon a section of the Royal Guard with an officer from the palace on Earl Greyharbor's authority. I was to take the summons personally and directly, to return with the guardsman, and to have no discussion with anyone else along the way. I said I would, of course, and hurried off. As soon as I found one of the Duke's under-footmen, I passed the same instructions to him and left the townhouse."
"And?"
"And, Your Highness..."
For the first time, Willems' voice and body language showed a hint of trepidation.
"Because I had no way of knowing what might have passed between the Duke and the Earl, or if the Duke had been taken alive, I executed my contingency instructions from Baron Shandir. I went to Brady Lahang's quarters and killed him."
Narmon sat very still for a moment, long enough for the apparently unflappable Willems to begin sweating, then nodded.
"That was well done, Master Willems," the prince said.
"Indeed, it sounds as if you did very well that evening."
"Thank you, Your Highness."
Willems' taut shoulders relaxed perceptibly, and Narmon smiled slightly.
"But returning to this stranger in the library," he continued, smile fading into a faint frown of concentration, "you have no idea how he came to be there?"
"None, Your Highness." Willems shook his head.
"Do you have any idea who he was?"
"According to the gossip I managed to pick up while making my way out of Telisburg, it was the same man who broke up the attempt to assassinate Crown Prince Caleb, Your Highness,"
Willems said.
"The most persistent rumour was that this man, Merlin, or something of the sort, had been given a commission in the Royal Guard as a reward for saving the prince's life."
Narmon's upper lip curled in what no one could ever have mistaken for a smile.
"It would appear we have a great deal to thank this Merlin for," he said softly.
"Yes, my prince," Shandir said, inserting himself into the interview.
Narmon's eyes moved to him, and he shrugged.
"The most interesting thing to me, in many respects, my prince, is that, according to the reports we've received so far from Telisburg, this Merlin accompanied Greyharbor to the Duke's townhouse. Master Willems' information is the first-hand account we've received, and the damage Wave Thunder's done to Lahang's network means we're unlikely to get any more reports like it. But my people here in Emerald have been pumping every ship's company from Karis for information.
And while there's a great deal of confusion and obvious nonsense in most of what we've been able to ferret out, there seems to be general agreement that the official story is that Grey Harbor took Merlin with him when he went to call upon the Duke, which he obviously didn't, if Master Willems didn't see him arrive, Narmon said thoughtfully.
Your Highness, Willems put in diffidently, as I say, I didn't see him arrive, and he wasn't present when I delivered the brandy. I didn't personally take the instructions to Grey Harbor's coachman to take the Earl's carriage and horses to the stable, though. I sent the word via one of the underfootmen. So it's possible he was with the carriage at that time, and somehow managed to enter the library in the interval between my delivery of the brandy and Johnson's arrival.
But from your tone, you don't think it was likely, Narmon observed.
No, Your Highness, I don't. It's possible, however. I didn't waste any time talking to any of the other servants when I left. It may be that one of them admitted this Merlin, and he somehow got past me to the library without my seeing him. But I don't think that's what happened.
Then how did he get there?
Your Highness, I don't know. All I can say is that I never saw him, and that there were rumors in Telisburg that this Merlin is some sort of Sejin.
Lahang reported the same rumor in his message immediately after the assassination attempt, my prince, Shandi reminded Narmon, and the rotund prince nodded.
But why should they put it about that he accompanied Grey Harbor if, in fact, he didn't? Pine Hollow put in, his expression perplexed.
A moment, Travis, Narmon said, raising one hand, and looked back at Willems.
Have you anything else to report, Master Willems?
Not about events in Telisburg, Your Highness, Willems bowed once more. I'm still working on my report to Baron Shandir concerning my journey to Erastor and what I saw and heard along the way, but I believe that's all I can tell you about what happened in the capital.
Then I thank you, both for your service and for your information. I'm sure Baron Shandir will have many more tasks for a man of your proven capabilities. In the meantime, I assure you that you'll soon receive a more substantial token of my appreciation.
Thank you, Your Highness, Willems murmured.
Leave us now, if you please, Master Willems.
Of course, Your Highness.
Willems bowed yet again and retired, walking backward out of Narmon's presence as protocol required.
Wait for me in the antechamber, Willems, Shandir said quietly, and Willems nodded as he stepped through the door and it closed behind him.
Now, Travis, Narmon said to his cousin, you were saying?
I was just wondering why Harald and Wave Thunder should be telling everyone this Merlin character went to Tyrion's townhouse with Grey Harbor if that's not what really happened.
I don't know, Narmon conceded, and looked at Shandir.
Hal?
All any of us can do at this point is guess, my prince, the Baron said. At first glance, I can't really see a reason for them to do so, unless...
Unless what? Narmon prompted.
My prince, Shandir said slowly, this isn't the first time we've heard someone claim this man is a Sejin.
No, it isn't, Pine Hollow agreed.
But surely you're not suggesting he really is one, Hal.
I don't know.
Shandir gave a shrug of frustrated ignorance.
I just know that apparently he specializes in hacking up large numbers of people working for us, and that the destruction of our entire Karis network coincides with his arrival in Telisburg. If you can tell me how a single man could kill or disable 16 picked guardsmen and either kill or capture Duke Tyrion, never mind how he got into the library in the first place, I'll be delighted to hear it.
At the moment, it sounds to me like all the bad ballads about Sejin I've ever heard.
He has a point, Travis, Narmon said, but there's another point that interests me as well.
Both his nobles looked at him, and he shrugged.
Willems carried out his orders and killed the Hang before he could be taken into custody, correct?
The others nodded, and he snorted.
In that case, where did they get the information they obviously had to have for Wave Thunder to completely demolish our spy rings?
That point had occurred to me as well, my prince, Shandir said. I know we'd assumed initially that they must have started with Lahang, or with Tirion and Lahang, and worked their way down the chain after breaking one of them. Based on what we know so far, it's still possible they did take the Duke prisoner, but he shouldn't have known enough for them to identify so many of our other agents. So they must have identified Lahang already, Pine Hollow suggested.
If they'd already had him under surveillance, they might have identified at least some of his people as well. And if something, like that assassin they took alive, started them sniffing around the Duke, then when Willems carried out his instructions to remove Lahang, they probably started snapping up everyone they already knew about and questioning them pretty damn severely. If that's what happened, then each one they broke might have led them to others until the entire mess unraveled.
That's certainly one possibility, Shandir acknowledged. There's no way for us to tell either way from here, of course, and it's going to take us time to even begin rebuilding in Karis. Still, I think we need to keep a close eye on this Merlin of theirs. Whether or not he's really a Saijin, things do seem to start happening when he's around, which suggests to me, my prince, the Baron smiled coldly, that we might want to consider seeing to it that he isn't around much longer.
February, Year of God, 891. 1. King's Harbor, Helen Island.
I still say you don't sweat enough, Merlin.
Merlin opened one eyelid and glanced at Caleb. Nimmu Alban had come from a culture and a genetic heritage which had thoroughly digested the perils of skin cancer and the advantages of sunblockers. Caleb hadn't. He was extraordinarily fond of sunbathing, and there was no good way for Merlin to explain the downside of soaking his epidermis in sunlight to him. Nor could Merlin very well turn down the honor, and it was a genuine honor, of being invited to share the sun with the kingdom's crown prince. Fortunately, he could adjust his skin's coloration at will, which meant his own complexion had become almost as bronzed as Caleb's own. And he'd also gone into his programming after that exciting rugby game and disabled certain functions. As a result, that particular problem hadn't recurred, although Merlin had to admit, very privately, that Caleb Armok really was an extraordinarily attractive young man.
"And I still say that some of us don't need to sweat as much as others of us," he replied, and Caleb chuckled.
"What do you think of Hausman's proposal?" the prince asked after a moment, and Merlin opened both eyes at the change of subject. He sat up, reached for a towel, and mopped the relatively meager sweat to which Caleb had referred from his face.
"I think it makes excellent sense," he said then, and reached for the flask of chilled fruit juice they'd brought with them when they headed for the top of the harbor manager's office. That office was at the very end of one of the main wharves in the Citadel Basin, the purely military anchorage under the looming walls of King Harbor's main fortifications. It was an excellent perch for hopeful fishermen, and its location exposed it to a cooling breeze when the wind was in the southwest. That made it a popular sunbathing spot with the garrison's senior officers as well, and there were special attractions in Caleb's case. Specifically, his bodyguards liked the fact that they could make sure the office was empty, then throw a cordon across the wharf between it and the shore and allow the prince at least the illusion of privacy. Caleb treasured it for the same reasons, which made the invitation to accompany him this afternoon even more of an indication of his high regard for Merlin. Now Merlin took a swig of juice which was at least still cool, if no longer chilled,
He didn't really need it, of course, but that didn't keep him from savoring the taste before he passed the flask across to Caleb. "One of our main worries has always been the manufacturing time for the artillery," he continued as the Crown Prince drank gratefully. "I assumed all along that we'd have to cast every gun we needed if we wanted them to have trunnions." He shrugged. "The only way I could see to do it was to melt the existing guns down to reclaim the bronze and recast them from scratch." He stood and stretched, draping the towel around his neck, and walked across to the waist-high wall which ran around the top of the flat office roof. His neatly folded clothing and weapons were stacked on the bench seat which ran around the inside of the parapet, with his sheathed wakizashi weighing the pile, and an awning provided a band of shade as he leaned on the wall and gazed out across the harbor. The unoccupied office's wall fell sheer to the wharf's outer end, and the water was an almost painful blue, shading to equally bright green as it shallowed. There wasn't very much breeze today, even this far above water level. A gentle swell rolled lightly across the sun-bright water, and six or seven children in a four-oared launch were rowing steadily, if not exactly in a straight line, towards the wharf. The fishing poles sticking out of the boat at various angles indicated what they'd been doing, and Merlin felt a twinge of wistful envy as he remembered fishing trips from Nemu's childhood. They were still the better part of 100 yards out, but the 7 or 8-year-old girl sitting on the forwardmost thwart saw him looking at them and waved. He waved back, then turned his back to the harbor as Caleb rose and joined him in the shade. "It never occurred to me," Merlin continued the thread of their conversation, "that it might be possible to add trunnions to existing guns." Caleb grunted in agreement. There was an intriguing jumble of odds and ends on the roof, presumably left by other sunbathers and fishermen, and one of the prince's eyebrows arched as he discovered the harpoon propped in one corner. He picked it up, trying its balance idly, and looked across at Merlin. "What was that phrase you used the other day?" he asked. "Thinking outside the box, wasn't it?" Merlin nodded, and the prince shrugged. "Well, I guess we should just feel fortunate Hausmann is so good at it." "That's putting it mildly, Your Highness," Merlin said with a grin, and turned to glance back at the launch. The girl in the bows waved again, and he chuckled. Caleb was right, he thought. Edward Hausmann had come at the problem from a completely different angle. He'd pointed out that the gun the Royal Carisian Navy called the Kraken, a 6.5-inch cannon roughly 11 feet long and throwing a round shot which weighed just under 35 pounds, came close to meeting the requirement Merlin and Captain Seamount had settled upon. It also happened to be the closest thing the Navy had to a standard heavy gun, which meant it was available in greater numbers than most other types. There were others, some much heavier, like the Doom Whale, which weighed over 4.5 tons and threw a 62-pound shot, or the even vaster Great Doom Whale, a 6-ton monster which threw a 75-pound shot. Those, however, were far too heavy for their purposes. Eventually, all of them undoubtedly would be melted down to provide the bronze for sensibly sized replacements, but for now, they were effectively useless. What Hausmann had suggested was standardizing on the Kraken and welding an iron band around the gun tubes of as many of them as they could get their hands on. The band would be cast with trunnions, which could be done far faster than casting and boring an entire new gun. It wouldn't be as strong as casting the trunnions into the gun itself, but it would do as a temporary quick fix. And as time allowed, the guns would, indeed, be melted down and recast. It wasn't a perfect solution. The supply of Krakens was scarcely unlimited, after all, but it would save a lot of time and resources, and given the new carronade design he and Seamount had worked out, it meant... A sudden scream jerked him out of his thoughts, and he wheeled back towards the harbor. The launch was no more than 70 yards from the wharf now, but one of the older girls was screaming, one hand pressed to her mouth, while the other pointed wildly at the trio of triangular fins sweeping towards the boat.
"Kraken!"
Caleb spat. He was suddenly leaning out across the roof parapet towards the boatload of children.
"Don't!"
he said, and it was obvious he wasn't talking to Merlin.
"Don't panic!"
But the children in the launch couldn't hear him. The oldest of them could not have been more than 14, and their sudden terror was evident in the ragged disorder of their oars. The boat rocked in the water as the screaming girl shrank back against the gunwale on the other side away from the Krakens, then began to list as two more of the children joined her. The fins slashed through the water, closing on the boat, and suddenly one of the Krakens rose out of the water close alongside. It was the first time Merlin had actually seen one of the fearsome predators, which normally preferred water deeper than that of most harbors. A fully mature sea kraken was up to 20 or 22 feet of voracious appetite. Roughly similar in body form to an elongated terrestrial shark, its head was quite different. It had the round, many-toothed mouth of a lamprey eel, but with a difference. Over a foot across, almost 3 feet on fully mature krakens, it was fringed with a cluster of 10 powerful tentacles. Those tentacles were from 4 to 6 feet long, and normally lay flat back against the torpedo-shaped body as it swam. But when the kraken attacked, they reached out and seized its prey, holding it while the mouth savaged it. That would have been enough to explain the terror the creature evoked in any reasonably sane human being, but they were also intelligent. Nowhere near as intelligent as a terrestrial dolphin, perhaps, but smart enough to cooperate when they hunted, and smart enough to know boats contained food. The terrified children shrieked as the first kraken lifted its head, then shrieked again even more loudly as the second slammed into the launch from below. The boat leapt madly in the water, rocking so violently it almost capsized, and one of the boys went over the side. There was a swirl in the water. His head came up and his mouth opened, screaming in terrified agony, as one of the krakens took him from below and dragged him under.
"Shanwei!"
Caleb cursed helplessly, pounding the parapet with his fist, and the unbalanced launch heaved crazily as it was rammed again. This time, it went all the way up and over, spilling all of the children into the water. Merlin didn't stop to think. Before Caleb even realized his bodyguard had moved, Merlin's hand flashed out with literally inhuman speed and snatched away the harpoon with which the prince had been toying. His arm cocked, and then Caleb's eyes flew wide in disbelief, despite his horror, as the harpoon snapped out in a flat, vicious arc that ended a full 70 yards away. One of the krakens rose 2/3 out of the water, standing on its thrashing tail, tentacles releasing the mangled body of its victim as the harpoon struck it. No, Caleb realized, the weapon hadn't simply struck its target. It had driven completely through that massive barrel of solid muscle and bone. At least one of the wounded kraken's fellows turned upon it as its blood stained the water. But Caleb's heart froze within him as another screaming child, a girl this time, disappeared forever into the churning, bloody horror which had enveloped the peaceful harbor. And then he saw fresh movement out of the corner of his eye and reached out frantically. But he was too late to stop Merlin as he went over the roof parapet 30 feet above the surface of the water. Time seemed to have slowed impossibly, even as it flashed by. The Crown Prince saw everything, realized exactly what was happening, but he was a spectator. He could only watch as Merlin launched himself in a flat trajectory that carried him an impossible 20 yards before he hit the water. Merlin was already in midair before he realized what he was doing, by which time it was just a bit late for second thoughts. He hit the water and drove deep, despite his shallow trajectory. A flesh-and-blood human would have been forced to surface to regain his bearings, not to mention breathe, but Merlin was a pika. His built-in sonar told him exactly where the boat, the thrashing, screaming children, and the krakens were, and his legs propelled him towards the chaos with a powerful flutter kick no biological human could have produced. He'd snatched up his wakizashi without consciously considering it. Now he held its hilt in both hands, reversed 17-inch blade flat against the inside of his right arm to minimize drag as he drove through the water. It took him less than 20 seconds to reach the capsized launch. 20 seconds in which the kraken he'd harpooned wrenched frantically free of its attacking fellow and swam, brokenly, erratically, towards shallower water. 20 seconds in which a third shrieking child was dragged into the depths. But then he was there. The surviving children kicked and flailed frantically, fighting to climb on top of the overturned boat in search of even a few more moments of safety. An older boy snatched up one of the younger girls and literally threw her up onto the wet, slick boat bottom, even as one of the two remaining krakens knifed towards him with lethal grace. The tentacles reached out, snapping towards him like striking serpents. One wrapped around his ankle, yanking his leg towards a tooth-filled maw, but a human-shaped hand closed on the tentacle in turn. It locked down with the force of a hydraulic vise, and a battle-steel wakizashi drove downward directly behind the creature's bulging eyes. It slammed hilt-deep into the kraken's head, and the impossibly sharp blade sliced effortlessly through bone, cartilage, and muscle. The kraken's own movement added to the strength of the pika's arm, and the wakizashi continued its forward trajectory straight through the creature's brain and back out through its snout in a fan of blood. The tentacle deathlocked around the boy's ankle would have dragged him under with the still thrashing carcass, but a second quick slash of the wakizashi severed it 2 feet from the kraken's opened skull. The harpooned kraken's struggles were weakening as it writhed and twisted around the weapon driven through its body, but Merlin's sonar reached out, seeking the third. He found it, 20 feet beneath the surface, circling slowly as it ripped and tore at the remnants of its second victim. He curled into a ball, oriented himself, and snapped straight, driving himself towards the feeding monster. Had it realized something as insignificant as he might pose a threat to it, it could easily have fled at a speed not even a pika could have hoped to match. But it probably never even realized he was coming. Even at this depth, his light-enhancing vision could see clearly, but he refused to let himself look at the mangled ruin clasped in the kraken's tentacles. He had eyes only for the kraken itself, and his left hand darted out and grasped the dorsal fin. The kraken started to raise its head, as if in surprise, and the wakizashi drove down yet again. It sliced vertically through the thickest part of the creature's spine, directly in front of the fin, all but cutting the huge body in half, and it convulsed madly. It fell away from him, already dead, but still thrashing violently while its muscles tried to grasp the fact of its death, and he broke for the surface. The surviving children were still screaming, fighting desperately to climb onto the boat, and he drove the wakizashi to the hilt into the launch's keel for safekeeping.
"It's all right," he shouted. "It's all right. You're safe now."
They didn't seem to notice him, and he reached out for the youngest child still in the water. It was the girl who'd waved to him, he realized, and she screamed in terror, writhing desperately, until she realized it was arms about her, not a kraken's tentacles. Then she reached back for him, her own arms ready to lock strangulation tight about his neck. But he'd expected that, and his artificial muscles were more than a match even for her panic-driven strength as he boosted her up onto the overturned boat as gently as he could. She snatched at the keel, holding herself there, and he turned to pluck another child from the water.
"You're safe now,"
he shouted again, and this time someone actually seemed to have heard him. He heard another voice repeating the reassurance and realized it belonged to the boy who'd thrown the girl clear of the water. The familiar voice seemed to get through to the survivors where his own had not, and the worst of their panic began to subside. At least enough for all five of them to crawl up onto the boat and huddle there. Three of them clung to the keel with white-knuckled fingers, weeping in terror that twisted Merlin's heart. But worse than that were the two children, one of them the first girl he lifted out of the water, who kept calling out frantically for two brothers and a sister they would never see again. He stayed in the water, talking to them, trying to comfort them, and even as he did, a corner of his mind wondered how he was possibly going to explain this to Caleb.
"That was impressive," Crown Prince Caleb said quietly some hours later. He and Merlin sat in facing chairs in Caleb's quarters in the citadel. The sun had set, and the room was comfortably cool, dim in the lamplight, as Merlin looked at him expressionlessly.
"I don't believe," Caleb continued, "that I've ever heard of anyone killing a kraken, much less two of them, armed only with a short sword. Oh, and let's not forget the one you harpooned, at 70 yards. Say gin or no, Merlin, that was a remarkable feat."
Still, Merlin said nothing, and Caleb leaned back in his chair, his face shadowed. Silence stretched out for several seconds, and then the Crown Prince sighed.
"Would you care to explain just how you managed all of that?"
The prince's voice sounded extraordinarily calm and reasonable under the circumstances, Merlin thought.
"I can't, Caleb," he said after a moment. "I wish I could. Truly I do. But I can't."
"Merlin," Caleb said quietly, "I don't care if you're a Saiyajin. No mortal man could do what I saw you do this afternoon. No one. Not even a Saiyajin. I asked you once before what you truly were, and you promised me you serve light. But what sort of servant are you?"
"Caleb, Your Highness," Merlin said softly, "I can't tell you that. Not don't want to, not refuse to, but can't."
"You're asking a great deal of me, Merlin," Caleb said in that same quiet voice. "My father trusts you. Trusts you enough to commit his entire kingdom to accepting your services, your visions, and all the knowledge and suggestions you've brought us. And I've trusted you as well. Were we wrong? If you can do what mortal men can't, that makes you more than mortal. And how am I to know if someone who must be either angel or demon speaks the truth?"
"I'm neither angel nor demon," Merlin replied. "I swear that. I simply can't tell you what I am. Not now, possibly never. And I suppose you're just going to have to decide for yourself whether or not you can trust someone who can't answer those questions for you."
He looked straight across at Caleb, and Caleb looked back into those strange sapphire eyes. The Crown Prince gazed deeply into them without speaking for at least a full minute. Then he inhaled deeply.
"You didn't have to do what you did this afternoon." His conversational tone sounded so normal it was almost bizarre, under the circumstances.
"If you hadn't, I wouldn't have known what I know now, would I?"
"No," Merlin agreed, "you wouldn't. But that doesn't mean I didn't have to do it."
"No, it doesn't," Caleb said. And then, to Merlin's astonishment, he smiled. It was an almost gentle expression, and the prince shook his head.
"And that, Merlin, is the reason I do trust you."
"You do?" Despite himself, Merlin couldn't quite keep the surprise out of his own tone, and Caleb chuckled softly.
"You showed me what you can do, the proof you're more than even a Saiyajin, to save a pack of harbor urchins you didn't even know. You risked all the trust you've built up with me and my father for that. And I believe you did it without ever once considering not doing it."
"You're right. I didn't consider not doing it." Merlin shook his head. "I probably should have, but it never even crossed my mind."
"And that's why I trust you," Caleb said simply. "A man,
or even more than a man, who served darkness would never have let the lives of a handful of harbor brats weigh against his purposes. But you did. If you're prepared to risk throwing away all that you've already achieved in order to save the lives of children, that tells me all I really need to know. Which isn't, he flashed a sudden smile, suspiciously like a grin, to say that I wouldn't like to know more, of course.
Your Highness, Merlin said, not even trying to keep the relief out of his voice. On the day I can tell you more, if it comes, I will, I swear.
I hope that day comes, Caleb replied. For now, though, I think you and I need to spend some time coming up with some sort of explanation for this afternoon. The good news is that no one on the shore, besides me, was in a position to see what actually happened. The bad news is that the children's version of what happened is pretty outrageous.
You know how excitable children are, Your Highness, Merlin smiled. I'm not a bit surprised if it all seemed even more impressive to them than it actually was.
All well and good, Caleb said rather more soberly. They've already brought in the carcass of one kraken, though, the one you harpooned. Trust me, there were more than a few raised eyebrows over that, even after I, understated the range for the cast somewhat, let's say.
Are there going to be even more if they bring up the other two?
Oh, I believe you can safely say there would be, Merlin admitted. And would that have something to do with the knife you stuck completely through the keel of that launch? Caleb asked politely.
As a matter of fact, it would.
Wonderful. Caleb puffed his cheeks thoughtfully, then shrugged. At least they were still in the main ship channel. The one you harpooned found its way into shallower water before it finally died. But the water's deep out there, and I understand there's a nasty tidal scour. We can at least hope the other two won't be recovered at all.
That would undoubtedly be best, Merlin agreed, and sat for several seconds, gazing at the prince.
Are you sure you're comfortable with this, Caleb? He asked finally.
Comfortable isn't the word I'd choose. Caleb's smile was crooked. In fact, it's not remotely close to the word I choose, but if you mean am I going to have second thoughts, the answer is no.
I appreciate that, Merlin said gently, deeply.
Well, let's look at it, Caleb suggested. So far you've saved my life, saved Regis's life, dealt with what was probably the most dangerous traitor in the kingdom's history, broken both of the major spy rings in Karras, taught us the things which may actually save us from destruction, and now rescued five of my father's subjects from certain death. I'd say you've built up a considerable positive balance with me, so far at least.
I hadn't quite thought about it that way.
Then you should have. As a matter of fact...
Caleb broke off as someone knocked at the door. He grimaced and shook his head irritably.
I left instructions that we weren't to be disturbed, he said, then stood and faced the door.
Enter!
He called in a voice which boded ill in the absence of a very good excuse for whoever was on the other side of the door. It opened, and Arnald Falcon looked at the prince apologetically.
I realize you left orders not to disturb you, Your Highness, he said, but there's a courier boat from Telesburg.
He held out an envelope sealed with the crimson wax bearing King Harald's personal seal. Caleb took it, his face suddenly expressionless, and broke the wax. Stiff, heavy paper crackled as he unfolded the brief message inside and read it. Then he looked up and met Merlin's gaze with a thin smile.
"It seems you and I are required in Telesburg, Merlin," he said. "The church's intendant has expressed a desire to speak to us."
2. Royal Palace, Telesburg. It was the first time Merlin had ever met Father Pater Wilson, and as the upper priest was ushered into the throne room, he devoutly wished that the meeting might have come under other circumstances.
almost any other circumstances. Wilson was a young man, older than Caleb, but probably no older than Nimue Alban had been at the time of her biological death. He was slender, with red, curly hair, and a lively intelligence seemed to hover behind the gray eyes which, along with that hair, would have marked him as a foreigner to any Carisian. He also wore the purple habit of the Order of Schuler, and the embroidered sword and golden flame on his sleeve marked him as the church's intendant in Carus as well. He followed the chamberlain to the foot of the dais and bowed gravely, first to Harald, then to Bishop Michael, who stood at the king's shoulder, and finally to Caleb. "Your Majesty?" His voice was a pleasant tenor, his accent that of the temple and the city of Zion's elite.
"Father," Harald returned, his own soft Carisian accent sounding stronger than usual in contrast to the upper priest's.
"I thank you for agreeing to see me on such short notice," Wilson continued. "And I thank you for joining us, Your Eminence," he added, with another small bow to Bishop Michael.
"You're most welcome, Father," the bishop said. "And allow me to thank you for notifying me you intended to seek this interview. The courtesy is deeply appreciated."
Wilson smiled and waved his hand in a tiny gesture of dismissal, as if his notification to Stainer had been a matter of no consequence. But it most definitely had not been any such thing. As the church's intendant, Father Pater had the authority to go anywhere at any time of his choosing and interrogate anyone he chose without advance notice to anyone in the entire kingdom, including Bishop Executor Gerald.
"Your message requested the presence of Crown Prince Caleb and Lieutenant Athrawes," Harald observed after a moment. "As you observe, both of them are present. May we now know the reason for which you wish to see us?"
"Of course, Your Majesty." Wilson inclined his head in what was not quite a bow this time, but was still a gesture of respect. "I fear certain reports have reached the temple concerning matters here in Carus," he said calmly. "Most, I suspect, are the product of natural exaggeration. Some, alas, may be maliciously intended by those whose interests are not identical to those of your kingdom, let us say. However, when there's this much smoke, the Council of Vicars and the Office of the Inquisition feel an obligation to be certain there's no fire underneath it. Hence my request for this interview." Harald sat silent for several seconds, gazing at the young upper priest, his own expression thoughtful. Merlin kept his own face completely expressionless as he stood behind Caleb's chair, but his mind was busy considering Wilson's explanation. The upper priest's tone was calm and measured, but there was an undertone, a hint of something which might almost have been exasperation, and Merlin remembered a brief conversation with Bishop Michael about the reasons Wilson might have been assigned to Carus.
"Forgive me, Father," Harald said after a moment, "but I must assume any such reports would be in reference to the new processes and devices which have been introduced here in Carus over the past few months. It was my impression all of those had been examined and found free of taint."
"You're quite correct, Your Majesty," Wilson agreed. "I have indeed personally examined all the processes and devices which were submitted, exactly as they ought to have been, to the office of the intendant for approval. And it was, indeed, my determination that none of them even approached a violation of the prescriptions. That remains my opinion." Had Merlin still been a being of flesh and blood, he would have inhaled a deep breath of relief. But Wilson wasn't finished, and he raised one hand slightly towards the king in a semi-apologetic gesture. "Unfortunately, Your Majesty, I've been directly instructed by Archbishop Erech to reconfirm my original determination. His semaphore message was, of course, quite terse, and didn't include the reasons he felt made such a reconfirmation desirable.
I can only surmise that it's the result of those exaggerated reports I've already mentioned.
I see. And I understand your responsibility to obey the Archbishop's instructions, of course. However,
Harald allowed an edge of concern to creep into his voice.
Since we'd been assured all of these things were acceptable, we've already begun moving ahead with many of them. If we have to begin the examination process all over again, it's going to cause great hardship and not a little financial loss for many of our subjects who have acted in good faith.
Believe me, Your Majesty, I'm well aware of that, Wilson said. I've given this matter a great deal of thought since receiving the Archbishop's message. I'm entirely comfortable in my own mind with my original ruling on everything which has been submitted to my office. While I certainly owe the Archbishop my zealous obedience, I truly see no point in repeating the examination and testing process, as I feel confident my conclusions would be the same at the end of the effort. At the present time, however, I'm inclined to doubt that any remonstrance to the Archbishop on my part would be of service to your kingdom's interests. Merlin's eyes narrowed, and he sensed the stiffening of Caleb's shoulders. Young Father Pater was widely regarded as disdainfully oblivious to the political realities of the Church of God Awaiting's internal factions and how secular rulers tried to use them to advantage, which made his last sentence even more interesting than it might otherwise have been. While I may feel the Archbishop's concerns, assuming they are in fact his concerns and not those of the Council of Vicars, are misplaced, Wilson continued, I'm bound by both my formal vows and my duty as one of God's priests to fulfill his instructions to the very best of my ability. After much thought, I've concluded that the true nature of the concerns being expressed has less to do with the actual processes and devices I've already approved in Mother Church's name than with the future to which they may lead. Which, Merlin thought more than a little apprehensively, shows even more political insight on his part, and cuts right to the chase in one simple sentence. The writ does warn us that change begets change, and that Shanwei's temptations find their way into our hearts one step at a time, Wilson said gravely. In that respect, I understand the Archbishop's legitimate concerns, and to be totally honest, I find I share them in some small degree. Your people here in Caris are a boisterous lot, Your Majesty. I've come to like and admire them, but it may be that those within Mother Church who feel some apprehension about their taste for constantly improving how they do things have some justification for their worries. Because of that, and as a means of addressing what I believe was the Archbishop's intent, I've decided, after much prayer and meditation, how I believe I ought to proceed. I propose to cut directly to the heart of the Archbishop's concerns.
In what way, Father?
Harald asked, just a bit warily.
In this way, Your Majesty, Wilson replied, and reached for his pectoral scepter of Langhorn. It was larger than most, and exquisitely gemmed, exactly the sort of scepter which might have been expected from someone of Wilson's familial wealth and prominence. But no one else in the throne room expected what happened when Wilson took it in both hands and twisted. The scepter's crowned head came off, exposing the fact that the end of its staff projected into a gold-lined hollow inside the head. Wilson released the head, letting it hang from the golden chain about his neck, and touched the staff's projecting end with the tip of his right index finger. And as he touched it, it began to glow. Harald, Bishop Michael, Caleb, and the king's bodyguards all stared transfixed at that steadily strengthening blue glow. So did Merlin, but for completely different reasons. This, Wilson said softly, is a treasure of Mother Church which was entrusted to my family centuries ago.
According to the traditions which have been passed down with it, it was placed with us by the Archangel Shula himself. He touched his heart and then his lips, and everyone else in the throne room, including Merlin, did the same. The nature of the Stone of Shula, Wilson continued, is that if any lie is spoken by someone while touching it, the stone will turn the color of blood. With your permission, Your Majesty, I propose to ask each of you in turn a few simple questions. The stone will confirm for me the truth of your responses, and that, coupled with the examinations I've already carried out, will allow me to respond to the Archbishop's concerns in good faith. He met Harald's gaze directly, his expression and manner radiating sincerity, and placed his own hand on the glowing blue crystal. No one outside a few members of my own family knows where the stone has been bestowed in this generation, he said. In fact, most of the church believe it was lost forever at the time of Saint Everard's death. I do not lightly reveal it to you at this time, but I have concerns of my own about the nature of the allegations being made against Caris from within the temple. It was obvious to Merlin that it was almost physically painful for the young upper priest to admit that, but the crystal burned steadily blue, and Wilson continued unflinchingly. I believe God sent the stone to me for this very moment, Your Majesty. I believe he intends me to answer my own concerns so that I may know how best to answer those of others. He stopped speaking, and Merlin held his mental breath as Harald the Seventh of Caris looked deep into the young upper priest's eyes. Unlike Harald, Merlin knew exactly what had been hidden inside Wilson's reliquary, not that he'd ever expected to see it. It was a verifier, the ultimate development of the old, clumsy, pre-space lie detector. Unlike earlier attempts to produce a reliable means of determining truthfulness, the verifier used the brain waves of the individual being questioned. Under the law of the Terran Federation, verifiers could not be used without an explicit court order, and even then there had been stringent safeguards, limitations on the questions which could be asked, to prevent fishing expeditions or witch hunts. Even the verifier hadn't been a perfect guardian of truth. In almost a century of use, no instance of a verifier's inaccurately reporting a knowing lie as the truth had ever been reported. But it could only tell an interrogator whether or not the person he was questioning was telling the truth as he knew it. It didn't magically uncover truths no one knew, and certain mental disorders could return contradictory readings. The one in Wilson's hand might well really have come from Schuler. At any rate, it had to have come from one of Langhorne's command crew, and it had clearly been intended to continue functioning indefinitely. The crystal itself was basically a solid chunk of molecular circuitry, which could have been pounded on with a sledgehammer without suffering undue damage, but there had to be some provision for powering the thing. Merlin couldn't be certain, but it seemed likely that the same angel who'd given the relic to Wilson's family had instructed them in the ritual required to keep it charged, probably via a simple solar power converter built into the thing. None of which really mattered at this particular moment. What mattered was that the local representative of the Inquisition in Caris had it.
I'm honored by your willingness to reveal this relic's existence, Father, and by both your trust in our discretion and your determination to judge these matters justly, Harald said finally. For myself, I fear no just question. He didn't even look at the others. We will answer what you ask, he said.
Merlin stood very still behind Caleb's chair as Wilson approached the king. The upper priest extended the verifier, and Harald touched it firmly, without hesitating, despite its unearthly glow. He looked across the blue light, which turned his fingers almost translucent, and met Wilson's eyes levelly.
"I'll keep my questions as brief as I may, Your Majesty," the upper priest promised.
"Ask, Father," Harald replied steadily.
"Very well, Your Majesty." Wilson cleared his throat. "Your Majesty, of your knowledge, do any of the new processes, devices, or concepts which have been or will be introduced here in Karis violate the prescriptions of Zhuojing?"
"They do not," Harald said in formal, measured tones, and the verifier glowed steady blue.
"Do you know of any individual here in Karis who would oppose God's will for Safehold?" Wilson asked, and Merlin held his mental breath.
"I know of no one here in Karis who would act in opposition to the will of God," Harald said. "I don't doubt there are some, for there are always those who prefer evil to good, but if they exist, I do not know who they may be or where."
Again, the verifier continued to glow. "Do you, as an individual and a monarch, accept God's plan for Safehold salvation?" Wilson asked, and this time Harald's face tightened as if with a flicker of anger, but he replied in that same measured tone.
"I accept God's plan for this world, for my kingdom, and for myself," he said,
and the verifier burned clear blue. "Do you intend ill to any who do not intend ill to you?" Wilson asked very quietly, and Harald cocked his head slightly.
"Forgive me, Father," he said across the blue glow of the verifier, "but that question would seem to me to go just a bit far afield."
Wilson began to open his mouth, but the king shook his head before he could.
"Nonetheless," Harald continued, "I'll answer it. You've extended your trust to me, and so I'll extend mine to you. In answer to your question, I intend ill to no man who does not intend ill to me or the subjects for whose lives and safety I am responsible."
The verifier continued to glow, and Wilson bowed profoundly to the king and stepped back.
"I thank you, Your Majesty," he said, and looked at Caleb.
"Your Highness," he said, and Caleb stretched out his hand as fearlessly as his father had.
"You heard the king's answers to my questions, Your Highness," Wilson said. "May I ask if you are in accord with his responses?"
"I am."
"Do you share your father's beliefs on these matters?"
"I do."
"Thank you, Your Highness," Wilson said, as the verifier continued to glow brightly.
Then he looked at Merlin.
In addition to his concern about allegations of violations of the prescriptions, the Archbishop informed me there have been reports of malign influences in the king's councils. He named no specific names, but I would imagine any such rumors probably focus on you, Lieutenant Othrawes. You are, after all, a stranger, and there are persistent rumors that you're also a Sejin. The Archbishop didn't specifically instruct me to investigate those rumors, but it would be of great value to me, and a relief to my own mind, if you would permit me to do so.
Merlin looked back at him for several seconds, sensing the tension which suddenly ratcheted higher in Caleb. Then he smiled crookedly and bowed to the upper priest.
"I never anticipated anything quite like this, Father," he said with perfect honesty. "But if I can be of service, of course you have my permission."
He reached out his own hand and settled it over the verifier. As he did, a small green icon glowed in the corner of his vision, and he drew a deep mental breath at the confirmation that the verifier was fully functional. Its circuitry and programming had detected the fact that he was a Pika operating in autonomous mode. It had no way to realize he was operating under hacked software, nor would it have had any way to report that fact to Wilson. But it had been designed to interface with a Pika's Mollycirc brain, as well as with a human one, and it had dropped automatically into the proper mode. Which meant it would know if he lied to the upper priest.
"Are you a Seijin, Lieutenant?" Wilson asked. "I have some, but by no means all, of the abilities Seijin are reputed to have," Merlin replied calmly, choosing his words with deadly care. "I acquired them after many years in the Mountains of Light, but none of my teachers or instructors ever actually called me a Seijin." Wilson looked at the verifier's steady blue glow, then back up at Merlin's face. "Why have you come to Karis?"
"For many reasons," Merlin said. "Specifically, I came to this kingdom to place my services and my sword at its disposal because I admire and respect King Harald, and because I believe Karis offers men the best chance to live as God would truly have them live."
"May I assume from your last answer that you believe in God's plan for Safehold?"
"Father," Merlin said very steadily, "I believe in God. I believe God has a plan for all men everywhere, and I believe it's the duty of every man and woman to stand and contend for light against the darkness." The verifier didn't even flicker, and Wilson's intent expression eased unexpectedly into a slight, crooked smile.
"I was going to ask you several more questions, Lieutenant," he said, "but you seem to believe in comprehensive answers."
"One tries, Father," Merlin murmured, and he and the upper priest bowed to one another as Wilson stepped back from the dais, carefully deactivated the verifier, and returned it to its place of concealment.
"I thank you, Your Majesty, Your Highness, and you, Lieutenant Athrawes. I believe I know now what I needed to know in order to respond to the Archbishop's concerns."
"You're most welcome," Harald replied,
and Merlin wondered if the king's calm voice concealed as much relief as he felt.
"And now, Your Majesty, Your Eminence, I know you have many duties to attend to. With your permission, I'll leave you to them."
"Of course, Father," Harald said,
and Bishop Michael raised one hand in benediction.
"You've done well here today, Father," the bishop said. "Would that all Mother Church's priests were as faithful, zealous, and careful in discharging their responsibilities. The blessings of God and the archangels go with you."
"Thank you, Your Eminence," Wilson replied quietly.
Then he bowed once again, and he was gone.
3. King Harald V Stadium, Telesburg.
"Strike 3!"
The capacity crowd in King Harald V Stadium roared its disapproval of the call, but the white-clad umpire behind the plate ignored the shouts coming his way. Umpires, after all, were the only branch of Mother Church's hierarchy who were accustomed to catcalls and vociferous disagreement. Bishop Executor Gerald Adamson sometimes regretted that they were. It offended his sense of propriety for any of Mother Church's servants to be the subject of such abuse, although at least the Archangel Langhorne had been careful, when he established the writ's commandments for the game, to reserve the office of umpire for the laity. It wasn't as if the crowd were booing a consecrated priest, after all, and this time around, even the most violently protesting fan probably understood that the umpire's call had been the correct one. It would have been expecting a bit much out of them to admit it, though. The annual Kingdom Championship Series, yet again this year between the Telesburg Krakens and their traditional hated rivals, the Hyratha Dragons, was all tied up at 3 games each, and they were into the 7th inning of the deciding game with the Krakens trailing by 2 runs and the bases loaded, which made the second out on a called strike particularly painful. The crowd noise subsided to its normal background surf, with only an occasional voice still shouting speculative comments on the quality of the umpire's vision, and the next batter advanced to the plate. A derisive cheer went up from the spectators as he stepped into the batter's box. John Smoltz was one of the most dominating pitchers in the league, especially in the postseason, and he was normally immensely popular. But, like most pitchers, his batting performance was at best mediocre.
Not only that, but he'd hit into an inning-ending double play in his last at-bat, and the home crowd clearly expected to be disappointed by this one. Which circumstances, Adamson thought, had made the preceding batter's strikeout even more excruciating for the spectators. The bishop chuckled at the thought, then, as Smolth dug his cleats firmly in and tapped the plate with his bat, sat back in his comfortable, well-shaded seat in the box reserved for the church's use in every major baseball stadium. Everyone else in the stadium was focused on the drama unfolding on the sun-drenched field, but Adamson's smile faded. He himself had other, more weighty matters on his mind. In Harald V Stadium, the church box was located immediately to the right of the royal box. Gerald had only to turn his head to see King Harald and Crown Prince Caleb watching the beautifully manicured field intently, and he frowned ever so slightly at the sight. It was a troubled frown, but it had nothing to do with the current game. Gerald Adamson hadn't served as bishop executor for the Kingdom of Caris for so many years without gaining a certain sensitivity, even at this remove, to the political currents flowing about inside the temple. No one actually told him anything about them in so many words, as a rule, but he'd had a lot of experience reading Archbishop Erech's letters, and the latest set of dispatches had been even franker than usual. It was apparent to Adamson that his temporal masters were unusually anxious over the reports they were receiving, not all from him, about Caris. That was never a good thing, and the freak accident which had prevented the archbishop from making his scheduled pastoral visit left his bishop executor responsible for dealing with it, which, in Gerald Adamson's opinion, was an even worse thing. He chewed that unpalatable thought for a moment, then looked at the younger priest sitting beside him. Father Pater Wilson had a dark slash of purple amid the episcopal white and brown and green earth tones of the other bishops and priests filling the box. Competition for seating at the Kingdom Series was always ferocious, and technically, Wilson was considerably junior to some of the upper priests of other ecclesiastical orders who'd failed to win places in the church box this year. But that didn't matter. As Mother Church's and the Inquisition's intendant in Caris, the only member of the Carisian hierarchy functionally senior to the young, intent Schulerite was Adamson himself, which made the bishop executor more than a little uneasy. Priests like Wilson often pose problems for their administrative superiors, even under normal circumstances, which, unless Adamson much missed his guess, these circumstances were not.
"Tell me, Father," he said after a moment, "have you had any fresh thoughts on the matter we discussed Thursday?"
"I beg your pardon, Your Eminence." Wilson turned his head to face the bishop. "I was concentrating on the field, and I'm afraid I didn't quite hear your question."
"That's perfectly all right, Father," Adamson smiled. "I simply asked if you had any additional thoughts on that matter we talked about the other day."
"Oh," Wilson cocked his head, his expression suddenly much more thoughtful, then shrugged ever so slightly.
"Not really, Your Eminence," he said then. "I've pondered the Archbishop's latest dispatches and instructions very carefully, and, as you know, I've personally interviewed the King and the Crown Prince in light of them. I've also exhaustively reviewed my original notes from my initial examination of all the new processes and devices. And, as I told you I would, I've spent quite a few hours in my chamber praying earnestly over the matter. For the present, neither God nor the archangels," he touched the fingers of his right hand to his heart, then to his lips, "have vouchsafed me any additional insight, however."
"Strike one!"
the umpire called as the Dragons pitcher grooved a fastball right through the center of the strike zone. Smolth's late, awkward swing didn't even make contact, and several fans groaned only too audibly.
Wilson was one of them, and then he blushed as he realized he'd allowed the game to distract him from the conversation with his ecclesiastical superior. "I'm sorry, Your Eminence." His sudden smile made him look even younger, almost boyish. "I know I'm a good northern boy from the Temple Lands, but I'm afraid the Krakens have seduced my allegiance away from the Slash Lizards. Please don't tell Father. He'd disinherit me at the very least."
"Don't worry about it, Father." For all the somberness of his own thoughts and concerns, Adamson found himself smiling back. Despite the often ominous reputation of the Order of Schuler and Wilson's own frustrating insensitivity to the temple's internal political dynamic, the intendant was a very likable young man.
"Your secret is safe with me. But you were saying?"
"I believe I was going to say, before the umpire so rudely interrupted us, that despite all of my prayers and meditation, or perhaps because of them, I feel quite comfortable with my original judgment on these matters."
"Then you remain unconcerned about any violations of the prescriptions?"
"Your Eminence," Wilson said gravely, "as a member of the Order, and as Mother Church's intendant in Caris, I'm always concerned about possible violations of the prescriptions. Indeed, the Order clearly recognizes the need to be particularly vigilant here in Caris, this far from the temple, and I assure you I've attended to both the Grand Inquisitor's and the Archbishop's instructions in that regard most carefully. Nothing in any of the recent developments here in the kingdom, however, has even approached the threshold of a prescribed offense.